gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week of July 21st. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and more radical info can be found on the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey, hey.
This Week in Radical History, starting July 21st, 1916, U.S. Marines land in Haiti again to protect American interests. They'll go back again and again as well, the U.S. having a lot of interests to protect.
The men and women in our armed forces protect our borders and our people, not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita Banana, Exxon, and Halliburton. These are not isolated incidents of stupidity. They're part of a long, bloody history of foreign policy being conducted for the financial interests of the wealthy few.
Also on July 21st, 1954, the Geneva Accords are signed, ending the French colonization of French Indochina, a place also known as Vietnam. The U.S. discovering that the French might not be interested, but by God, the U.S. must have some special interest in Vietnam. Within a year, they'll have our first military advisors setting the stage for the Vietnam War. Also on July 1st, 1972, George Carlin is charged with disorderly conduct for performing his famous Seven Words Act in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
There are two things that I blame for the abysmal condition of this magnificent species that had such potential at one time, and that is religion and commerce. And those are the two things that hinder us here. I mean, the religious people say this is immoral, it is corrupting, and it will do bad things to your character if you even hear these words as a child or a grown-up or whatever. And commerce says if you say these things, the customers and the advertisers are going to run from you.
This Week in Radical History for July 22nd.
On this day, July 22nd, in 1863, American frontiersman Kit Carson was ordered by the military governor of New Mexico to get rid of the entire Navajo Nation. At first, Carson was shocked by the brutal nature of this plan and attempted to resign his position. But after being pressured to stay, he obediently began the forced removal of the Navajo people from their land. First, Carson and his men implemented a scorched earth policy, burning Navajo fields and homes and stealing their livestock. Carson then began attacking the Navajo strongholds that fought in resistance until the Navajo were forced to surrender. A few months later, 8,000 Navajos were forced to march 300 miles to Fort Sumner, where they were imprisoned for the next 4 years. Over 300 people died during the long walk, and many more died in imprisonment. This is just one of the many brutal atrocities committed against indigenous populations in the land of the free.
Also on July 22, 1938, Joe Louis defeats German boxer Max Schmeling. Because of the Nazi persecution of the Jews in Europe and Hitler's disdain for blacks, the fight had a mystic proportions, with Louis seen by many as fighting to uphold democracy and the race. He succeeded convincingly, ending the fight in the first round. Also on July 22, 1970, during the Alcatraz occupation by Indians of all tribes, the first child was born on the first freed Native American piece of land in the 20th century. Also on this date in 1995 in Israel, four foreign activists break padlocks and reopen the main gates to the Palestinian Hebron University in the West Bank, closed by Israeli security and occupation forces back in 1987.
On this day, July 23rd, in 1846, writer and philosopher Henry David Thoreau was thrown in jail for refusing to pay his $1 poll tax in protest of American slavery and the Mexican-American War. Thoreau had resisted his poll tax for 6 years because he did not support the government's use of the money. Although he was only in jail for one night, the experience deeply impacted him, and he began speaking out about the responsibility of individuals to hold their government accountable. 3 years later, Thoreau wrote Civil Disobedience, an essay explaining how the actions of the American government were controlled by only a few individuals rather than the people. Thoreau's essay was highly influential to many activists.
Also on this day, July 23rd, 1892, strikers battled Pinkerton thugs during the Carnegie Steel Strike in Homestead, Pennsylvania, as the Pinkertons, trying to import and protect scabs, opened fire on striking steel workers. In the ensuing battle, 3 Pinkertons and 11 Strikers and spectators are shot dead. Strikers militantly resisted the private goons hired by Henry Clay Frick to dislodge him from the plant grounds. They fought back with guns and homemade cannon. The strike, however, lasted for 4 months, but the company was able to restore production as winter approached and morale declined. Anarchist Alexander Berkman, on this day, would enter Frick's office and shoot him, trying to revenge the deaths of the strikers. As a side note, later in the year, Emma Goldman would horsewhip her old mentor, Johann Maust, for shit-talking Berkman's attempt. She horsewhipped him on stage and broke the whip afterwards. Also on July 23, 1908, Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semite Henry Ford would sell his first Model T. On July 30, 1938, Hitler presented the highest non-citizen award, Grand Cross, the Supreme Order of the German Eagle, to Henry Ford in Berlin. U.S. Senate reports in 1974 on Ford Motor Company's aid to Nazi war effort. Have you driven your Ford in support of the Nazis lately? Also on July 23, 1967, starts out of Detroit upheavals, 7 days of social unrest, fighting with cops, anti-business, anti-government actions, including looting, results in 43 dead, 2,000 wounded, and 5,000 made homeless. Largest U.S. riots in a century, sparks additional riots throughout the United States. Also on this date in 1968, police kill 7 in standoff with black nationalists in Cleveland, Ohio, triggering days of riots and 4 more deaths. Lastly, on July 23, 2004, preemptive harassment as FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force investigate info shops and anarchists throughout the country. In Lawrence, Columbia, Kirksville, Topeka, and St. Louis, agents served several anarchists with subpoenas, ordering them to report to the grand jury on the same day they were planning to go to Boston to protest the Democratic National Convention. Let freedom ring. This day in radical history for July 24th, labor organizer Mary Harris Mother Jones begins the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Theodore Roosevelt Summer Hole in Oyster Bay, Long Island, New York, to publicize the harsh conditions of child labor in Philadelphia textile mills. When Mother Jones first visited Philadelphia, she found child workers as young as 10-year-old with stooped shoulders and missing fingers and hands. In response, she organized the march. Mary Harris Mother Jones led striking children from Kennington Textile Mills in Pennsylvania on a 17-day march from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, where they hoped to confront Roosevelt in his summer home. About 300 men, women, and children were led by 3 children dressed as Revolutionary War soldiers. Along the way, they raised awareness of child laborers with rallies in eastern Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, and won the hearts of many. When Mother Jones and her army arrived in Coney Island, she was asked to speak. The result of the speech was The Wail of the Children, which is delivered today. When they reached Oyster Bay on July 29th, where Teddy Roosevelt was vacationing, he refused to see them. Our beloved Teddy Roosevelt would be quoted as saying, "The worst foe of the poor man is labor leaders, who tries to teach him that he is the victim of conspiracy and injustice." Of course, the children would have problems reading these reports in the newspapers, since they're often kept illiterate and had no fingers for turning the pages. Also on this day, July 24th, 1925, John T. Scopes, convicted in Tennessee of teaching evolution in high school, fined $100 and costs for monkeying around. Also on this date in 1950, German V-2 became the first rocket to be launched at Cape Canaveral, Florida. Big surprise, as the U.S. provided safe haven for thousands of Nazis following World War II, including known war criminals and hundreds of scientists who developed the Nazi-German rocket program. In the U.S. intelligence, there was no prohibition for hiring anyone in the Gestapo or SS, historians said. This was a don't-ask-don't-tell culture. Also on this date in 1974, House Judicial Committee debates Nixon's articles of impeachment, including obstruction of justice, abuse of presidential powers, using CIA, FBI, and IRS and other federal agencies to violate civilian constitutional rights and to create the Plumbers Group to engage in illegal acts, as well as failure to supply subpoenaed material to the committee. Failure to turn over subpoenaed materials. Same crimes, different times. Lastly on this date in 1983, women tag U.S. warplanes with graffiti at Greenham Commons in England. This week in Radical History for July 25th, 1648 in New World, York County Court upholds authority of colonists to kill on site any free Indians they see in settled areas. Also on July 25th, 1930, a white mob threatens to hang ranchers employing Filipinos in Washington, Filipinos being the Mexican of their time, or the Irish before them, or the Polish before them, or the Chinese before them. Just pick your wave of immigrants you vilify and marginalize. Also 1946, the crime, 2 young black couples are killed by a lynch mob at Moore's Ford Bridge over the Apache River. The 4 were tied up and shot hundreds of times in broad daylight by unmasked men. Murder weapons included rifles, shotguns, pistols, and machine guns. The Tuskegee Institute newspaper called it a lynching. The cover-up. Despite the intense investigation by the FBI, the killers remain free. The best people in town won't talk, says Georgia State Patrol officer, on the climate of fear and threat of retaliation that discourages law-abiding citizens to cooperate with the investigation. Again, in 2005, there was another attempt to bring the survivors of the mob to justice, but that failed as well. No justice, no peace. Also on a state in 1969, proving how everyone is equal in the United States, Senator Edward M. Kennedy drives a car in which Mary Jo Capaci is killed earlier in the week, receives a 2-month suspended sentence for leaving the scene of an accident, however nothing for killing Mary Jo.
On this day, July 25th in 1972, the Washington Star exposed the story of the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, a cruel medical study that the U.S. Public Health Service had been conducting on 399 poor black men for the last 40 years. The men, who were in the late stages of syphilis and lacked access to proper health care, were not in a position to deny this supposedly free treatment. They were never told that they had syphilis and were actually left untreated while slowly dying from the degenerative disease. The experiment had continued despite the World Health Organization's 1964 declaration that informed consent was mandatory for experiments involving human beings.
Also on this date, 1983 in Nicaragua, the American right-wing funded Contras torture and kill 15 at San Francisco del Norte. Reagan compares the Contras to the nobility of Abraham Lincoln. Also on this date in 1990, U.S. Ambassador Applegate tells Iraq President Hussein that the U.S. won't take sides in Iraq-Kuwait dispute, or perhaps it will invade and start the first Gulf War. It's one or the other. Also on this date in 1993, Lebanon. Israeli begins blasting targets in southern Lebanon. 130 die by the end of the month. 500,000 civilians flee the bombardment. Tune in again in 2006 as Israel and Hezbollah go at it. Lastly on this date, in 2001, Bush administration, high on image, short on principle, rejects the draft treaty on enforcement of biologic weapons ban. Saddam can't have them, but we sure can. This week in Radical History for July 26, 1860, Norton I declares the United States dissolved, turns over temporary powers to state governors, and declares himself emperor. This one-time very rich land speculator living in San Francisco even issues the Imperial of Norton Treasury notes from 50 cents to $20 denominations. Also on this date in 1874, the U.S. orders friendly Indians are to remain in fixed camps in Wichita Agency, Oklahoma Indian Territory and answer periodic roll calls to stop any possibility of them moving around freely. Also on this date in 1877, 30 workers killed at the Battle of Viaduct by federal troops in Chicago. The Battle of Viaduct, U.S. troops and 2nd Militia Regiments and police attack about 5,000 workers at Halstead and 16th Street in Chicago, Turner Hall raid. Police raid the hall during the meeting of the German furniture maker, killing one and wounding many. A judge later finds that the police are guilty of preventing the workers from exercising their right of freedom of speech and assembly. A grim reminder that the true function of police in the Army is not issuing traffic tickets, paying officer-friendly, or defending the shores of terrorism, but keeping its own citizens in line and the nation workers docile in the need of political and business powers that be. That editorial from the Daily Bleed website. Also on July 26, 1909, during the week of July 26 through August 1st, Barcelona presented a spectacular and full-scale insurrection, a largely spontaneous uprising with little guidance from Union and radical leaders. As reported in the London newspaper, what was happening here was amazing. A social revolution had broken out in Barcelona, and it had been started by the people. No one had instigated it. No one led it, neither the liberals nor the Catalonian nationalists, nor the republicans, nor the socialists, nor the anarchists. This, of course, would be a prelude to the Spanish Civil War. For on this date in 1936, the attempted fascist takeover of Spain begins, flattering Adolf Hitler agrees to provide aid to the fascist government. 4 days hence, Germany and Italy provides planes to airlift fascist troops from Africa to Spain. Of course, the United States, France, and England refuse to aid the people fighting the fascists. Also on July 26, 1947, National Security Act consolidates Armed Forces and newly created Department of Defense, replacing the War Department. It further establishes the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and the National Security Agency, NSA, and numerous other secret black budget government agencies outside public review and control. This marks what some argue is the beginning of the American global empire building and the end of the American Republic, with its gutting of the Constitution and the slide towards an American police state.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 26, in 1953, Cuban revolutionaries Fidel and Raúl Castro led an unsuccessful attack on the Moncada barracks in Santiago de Cuba. The attack was an attempt to overthrow Cuban President Batista, who who consistently protected U.S. interests at the expense of the Cuban people. Upon his release from prison, Castro joined forces with Che Guevara in Mexico and organized the 26th of July movement to liberate Cuba. After peaceful resistance tactics failed, Castro and Che resorted to armed guerrilla warfare, successfully overthrowing Batista in 1959.
One last item for July 26, 1967. Three black men were killed and nine others brutally beat in what was known as the Algerian Motel Incident. Detroit police, Michigan State Troopers, National Guardsmen, and private guards who had been directed to the scene, responding to a telephone report of a sniping, the police group invaded the Algiers Motel and interrogated 10 black men and two white women, none of whom were armed, for an hour. By the time the interrogators left, three men had been shot to death and others, including the women, beaten. The resulting Detroit riots included 40 deaths, 2,000 injuries, and 5,000 left homeless, involving more than 4,700 federal paratroopers and 8,000 National Guardsmen to quell the disturbance after this gross injustice at the hotel.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. This morning we feature an amazing conversation between radio host Tom Hartman and author and journalist Max Blumenthal. It runs a bit longer than our usual program, so we will get right to it.
Hello, I'm Tom Hartman in Washington, D.C., and tonight we talk to one man for the hour, journalist and author Max Blumenthal, in a special edition of Conversations with Great Minds. My guest for tonight's Conversations with Great Minds is award-winning journalist and author Max Blumenthal. Currently a senior writer at Alternet and a former fellow at the Nation Institute, Max is one of the leading American journalists covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's reported on the ground from war-torn Gaza and has written a series of best-selling books on the topic, including his latest, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza, a must-read account of a 2014 conflict that destroyed 10,000 homes, killed 2,200 people, and displaced 300,000 other human beings. Max Blumenthal, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. I'd like to start out with just kind of Middle East politics 101, if we could, because there's you know, so much language flying around, and people, there are assumptions made that particularly the average American understands, oh, this is what Hamas is, or Hamas, you know, if the Israeli pronunciation. Yeah, right. Or this is Hezbollah, or what. Yeah, let's talk about who the players are and how this situation got to where it is. And maybe for that, we have to dial all the way back to the 1950s and blowing up the King David Hotel. And, you know, I don't know where you want to start the story, but can you set the stage for us about how the Middle East got to where it is right now?
No, I actually can't explain a macro view of how the Middle East got to where it is today. But if you look at the catastrophe, the catastrophes that are filling the pages of newspapers daily, just look at the image of Aylan Kurdi, the little boy who washed up on the shore, which is, you know, this broadcast will air later, but this is what everyone's talking about right now, the migrant crisis. Like, tens of thousands of migrants are marching now from Budapest to Austria. There's upheaval in Europe. You can't look at this without looking at the legacy of colonialism, the great game in the Middle East, and the legacy of Zionist settler colonialism in historic Palestine. I mean, these are two of the major events, historical events, that destabilized the Middle East and set the stage for where we are today. Of course, so many things happened along the line. Arab autocracy and oppression is a major factor, internal repression. But you can't look at this. You can't look at what's happening now Of course, climate change is a factor, but you can't look at it outside of Sykes-Picot, outside of the great game that the great powers played, and outside of the foundation of the state of Israel.
So let's take those one at a time. What is the great game?
The great game was when the four great powers started slicing up the Middle East and creating these fake countries.
This is post-World War One.
Yeah. And so Sykes-Picot established what are the modern borders of the Middle East. And, you know, for example, the Hashemites were supporters of British imperialism in Iraq, and they were given Jordan, which is basically a fake state that's controlled by the Hashemites, which is mostly Palestinian. And they rule through authoritarian means. Syria was created in a similar fashion, and dictatorships emerged through the era of Arab nationalism in the post-colonial era, and actually wound up reinforcing these borders. And now you have the emergence of groups like Islamic State who are actually appealing to the long-standing resentment among Arabs across the Middle East about Sykes-Picot and about these borders, and about not being able to travel from one Arab state to another. And the Islamic State is basically saying we're going to create a giant caliphate with no borders. And so on a local level, this has appealed to a lot of people who previously couldn't enter Syria from Iraq. Obviously, Islamic State is the most barbaric group currently operating in the Middle East, but there are real resentments that they're appealing to.
And part of that has to do with the creation of the State of Israel and the evolution of the State of Israel.
Well, there used to be a railroad in Gaza. There used to be taxi services that would go from Jerusalem to Haifa in northern Israel, to Damascus, to Beirut. If you were a Palestinian prior to the foundation of the State of Israel, or if you were a Jew living there prior to the foundation of this ethnically exclusive, self-proclaimed Jewish state, you could have breakfast in Jerusalem, lunch in Damascus, and dinner in Beirut. Today, that is impossible. And if you are a Palestinian citizen of the State of Israel, 20% of Israel, of Israeli citizens are Palestinian Arabs, you will face criminal sanctions if you attempt to travel to Syria or Lebanon without the permission or knowledge of the government.
Some of the major players in the region, I mentioned Hamas and Hezbollah. Can you tell us who these groups are and how they came about and what their agenda is right now?
Well, Hamas currently controls the Gaza Strip. It was elected in Palestinian legislative elections in 2006, which were authorized by the U.S. and the Bush administration as part of its democracy promotion initiative in the Middle East, and also because they saw Hamas as an Islamist force that would help isolate Islamic extremist groups like Al-Qaeda, which is correct. Hamas has always been kind of opposed to these groups. And so Hamas won in those elections. Their legislators were kidnapped, and they managed to secure power through a civil conflict with Fatah, their rival, in the Gaza Strip. Hamas is portrayed as a terrorist group in the West. United States has an official policy of not negotiating with Hamas, even as it negotiates with the Taliban, even as David Petraeus, former central commander of U.S. forces, declares that Al-Qaeda is now a possible asset for the U.S. in the Middle East. But who is Hamas? Hamas emerged from the Muslim Brotherhood for many years, throughout the 70s and even the 80s. It had what was known as a quietist policy towards Israel, in which its leadership focused more on zakat, charity, and building up a capacity at the grassroots level in places like the poorest refugee camps in the Gaza Strip, rather than confronting Israel. Israel gave it a free hand to do so because this helped isolate the PLO, which was a more secular resistance group.
And Arafat's group.
Exactly. And, you know, during the 90s, Hamas emerged as what it described as its as an Islamic resistance group through its military armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades. And this is when it became involved in armed confrontation with Israel. These initially took the form of attacks mostly on soft Israeli targets, including suicide bombings against buses, restaurants, etc., that were initiated in 1994 after a fanatical settler from Brooklyn, a Jewish settler from Brooklyn, Brooke Goldstein, massacred 29 Palestinian worshippers at the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. So this was a response. Hamas's military wing didn't have the military capacity to challenge Israeli soldiers and troops directly. So the suicide bombing, the attack on soft targets, was sort of their weapon of choice. It was also a psychological weapon aimed at tormenting Israeli society, applying a price tag to Israeli attacks on Palestinian civilians. At the same time, Hamas's leadership and Al-Qassam's leadership, they were led by a guy named Yahya Ayash at this time, was capable of abiding by truces. And during a ceasefire, Ayash was assassinated. The Israelis had arranged through a Palestinian collaborator to hand him a cell phone that was actually that contained an explosive charge. It was detonated remotely by a helicopter, and it blew half of his head off. And this led to, and this was authorized by Shimon Peres, who's the Israeli Labor Party grand old man, who is seen as kind of a dovish leader, a peacenik even. He has a center for peace in Israel. He initiated this assassination, and it led to another wave of suicide bombings. So this, what we think of as a cycle, continued, but it was actually sort of a provocation. As the Second Intifada persisted in the early, from 2000 to 2005, suicide bombings began to wane. In 2005, Israel initiated what's known as the disengagement from the Gaza Strip, when it pulled out 9,000 fanatical settlers, and basically sealed off the Gaza Strip, laid siege to it, and began occupying it through the panopticon model of electrified fences, remote-controlled machine guns on concrete walls, a naval siege preventing Gaza's fishing fleets from going more than 3 miles at sea. Drones are now overhead 24 hours a day in the Gaza Strip, weaponized drones, and most people are unable to leave. And so when this happened, the Al-Qassam Brigades actually initiated a parallel strategy of militarization. They said, you know, the suicide bombing hasn't succeeded. It's been a moral catastrophe. It's been a PR catastrophe. But now we have the ability, through our tunnel network in the south of the Gaza Strip, which abuts the Sinai Peninsula, to import better weapons and become a sophisticated guerrilla force and challenge Israel directly. So I tell this story in my book, The 51-Day War, of how Gaza militarized, the Al-Qassam Brigades emulated the model of Hezbollah. And in this war that my book describes, it was a war, it wasn't just an assault by Israel, the Al-Qassam Brigades actually confronted Israeli military personnel directly, targeted the military almost exclusively in ground combat, and managed to kill a substantial number of Israeli soldiers. Of the 75 Israeli citizens who were killed in last summer's attack on Gaza, 68 were armed combat soldiers, which tells you something about Hamas and the Al-Qassam Brigade strategy, and should really raise questions about the labeling of this group as a terrorist group. It has no longer is demonstrating an intention to attack soft Israeli targets or to terrorize the civilian population.
You're suggesting basically that they're an army for an organization, a government that was actually democratically elected in Gaza. But we'll continue this in just a moment. More of tonight's Conversations with Great Minds with Max Blumenthal right after this break. Welcome back to Conversations with Great Minds. I'm speaking with journalist and writer Max Blumenthal, author of the new book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Max, we were talking about Hamas and the role that they play in Gaza. I want to continue that, but I noticed in the newspaper the other day that your dad had sent some. This is when, you know, when the Republicans were forcing Hillary to reveal her emails, that your dad had been forwarding some of your articles about the conflicts in Israel to her,
and she was responding, are you an informal advisor to Hillary Clinton?
I met her once for about 2 minutes when I was 16, and that's the extent of my personal contact with her. She seemed like a nice lady. I haven't spoken to her since then, and I actually wasn't aware about the content of these emails or that this was taking place, but it's not surprising. And he was forwarding her accurate information, forwarding her articles from Haaretz. His assessments have been completely vindicated by Netanyahu's behavior. His assessments were very critical of Netanyahu, and they've been vindicated. He forwarded her a survey I wrote on the growing international network of Islamophobia, which is this transatlantic right-wing network. It was the first real, one of the first long reports written on this network in U.S. media, and that's been completely vindicated with the rise of the far right in the EU and these rallies outside mosques in the U.S. So, and what he forwarded her that I had written about the attack on the Free Gaza Flotilla was completely accurate. So he was providing her with accurate information. But beyond that, I think what this shows is not something that's unique to my father or to me. It's something that's happening in Washington and that's been happening, which is that Israel is not spoken about in favorable terms in private quarters among the Washington establishment, particularly within the Democratic Party. AIPAC rules through fear, through intimidation, and through financial enticement. It doesn't have a solid, actual base in Washington of hardcore supporters. There's currently not enough of an opposition.
Outside of the evangelical community, perhaps?
That's what the Israel lobby calls its safety belt and the Bible Belt, and that's its only grassroots base. I mean, you go out in the Bible Belt, and you'll see a bunch of guys driving around in pickup trucks that have NRA stickers. You don't see people driving around anywhere in America with AIPAC stickers on their car. It's a completely top-heavy lobby, and that's the fear. That's why there's been so much hysteria in neoconservative media about the emails my father sent to Hillary and about the fact that some of my articles, which were completely accurate and have all been vindicated, were sent to her. Obviously, Hillary is going to listen to someone like her mega donor, Chaim Saban, who said, I'm a one-issue guy and my issue is Israel, more than she's going to listen to my assessments. They don't seem to have had any impact on her. But the fear among neoconservatives who increasingly dominate AIPAC, the front line of the Israel lobby, is that these discussions are happening. And I know they're happening because I know people in Washington. I grew up here. My book party that my parents hosted for me for my second book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, at their home, was reported as a scandal by the Washington Free Beacon, this Sheldon Adelson, Paul Singer-funded neocon Potemkin village operation. Mm. And I can understand why they were afraid, because many State Department officials were there. Many progressive operatives in Washington were there. People who have influence in Washington were there to listen to me. And when I spoke to that room, and I spoke of AIPAC in a critical way, in a harshly critical way, they cheered because they hate AIPAC here. Uh-huh. And with good reason. With good reason. I mean, if you believe in American empire, like you're David Petraeus, you're going to see AIPAC as an obstacle, just as if you believe in basic human rights and fairness like me. So AIPAC has set itself up. I think of the scene in The Wizard of Oz when the Wicked Witch finally is put to rest, and all the little people come out to dance. That's what's happening with the passage of the Iran deal, and that's what's going to happen when AIPAC is finally vanquished.
Vanquished?
And there's no question. I mean, you're starting to see bipartisan support erode.
How would you characterize the modern Israeli state?
The modern Israeli state?
I mean, AIPAC is one of the most visible faces here in the United States.
The fact that AIPAC is lobbying against the Iran deal almost entirely within the Republican Party is a reflection of what the modern Israeli state has become. It's become comprehensively right-wing with a Jewish Israeli population, especially the younger population that is consumed with eliminationist racism against Palestinians. It is is consistently ranked as the most militarized society in the world. It's a high-tech garrison state that is more increasingly religious, and among religious Jewish Israelis, fascistic opinions are common. You look at the Israeli Democracy Index, these polls by the IDI, the Israeli Democracy Institute, and it shows that young Israelis, by a majority, would refuse to sit in a classroom with an Arab, would refuse to live next door to an Arab. And the more that separation takes hold through the separation wall in the West Bank, through the siege of Gaza, and Palestinians disappear from Israeli society, the more these opinions become prevalent. Beyond that, you have a movement in the West Bank among the religious nationalist settler movement to create something that is like a Jewish version of ISIS. And these, this blueprint has been laid out by Meir Ettinger, who is the grandson of Rabbi Meir Kahana, who actually proposed in the 1980s a state of Judea, which would be a religious fascist state entirely ethnically pure, free of Palestinians from the river to the sea, which would, of course, require mass ethnic cleansing. It would be a Jewish version of ISIS. And Ettinger, in a series of blog posts, has spelled out how this will be implemented. And his group in the West Bank has been linked to the firebombing of Palestinian homes, including the Dawabsha family in Douma near Nablus, where a little infant boy was burned to death, Ali Dawabsha. So this plan that they're trying to implement, they're doing so through terror. They claim to be taking on the Israeli army, but if you're out in the West Bank, you can see that they operate almost under the protection of the Israeli army. And beyond that, 40 to 50% of the Israeli army's officer corps are religious nationalist messianists who are sympathetic to this kind of perspective. So the state of Israel is in a transitional phase. It has been since the collapse of the peace process in 2000, and we're starting to see its culmination. It's what I explain in my book, Goliath, that Israel is in a permanent right-wing reality. And these governments that have been led by Benjamin Netanyahu will increasingly take a far-right character. Netanyahu is actually at the hollow center of Israeli politics, although he's seen as a man of the right. The people that he's catering to in his governing coalition are well to his right, like the Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, who said that Palestinian mothers should be exterminated because their children are, in her words, little snakes. Netanyahu will cater to that. Just this week, the expression of opinions on Israeli news broadcasts was outlawed. The Israeli government aims to restrict donations to human rights NGOs based in Israel. Ofer Akunis, who is a close ally of Benjamin Netanyahu, said that that Joseph McCarthy was right in everything he said. And the McCarthyite atmosphere in Israel, in which anyone who takes a dissident opinion is driven out of public life. I mean, we've seen school principals and teachers in Israel being hounded for expressing opinions against the occupation, is transferring to the American environment and the Israel lobby, as it reflects the right-wing character of the Israeli government, will embrace a new McCarthyism and attempt to impose its regime of intimidation and fear on anyone in American academia, in American politics, in American public life who diverges from the position of the Likud government. We saw that attempted most recently with with Stephen Salaita, the academic at the University of Illinois, professor of Native American Studies, who was stripped of his job for tweets he published critical of Israel's assault on Gaza last summer. And we're seeing it on campus after campus. We're seeing it in legislation that aims to bar American companies from refusing to do business inside Israel. and Sheldon Adelson, one of the key donors of the Republican Party, and Haim Saban, one of the top 10 donors to the Democratic Party, close friend of the Clintons, have both ponied up tens of millions of dollars, maybe $100 million, to fight the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement on campus. So it's going to get ugly. Mm. And that's a reflection of what Israel is today. What I'm saying is that we don't know where Israel's borders are. We know where it starts, but we don't know where it ends. And it affects us too here. The special relationship with Israel is corroding whatever's left of American democracy.
Yeah. Countries tend to go right wing when they're under stress.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost a cliche. And typically, hard right governments eventually lead to the disintegration of the state or to revolt. Is there an analogy to be made here between what's going on in Israel right now and what happened in, for example, South Africa and in the year or three or five before that big transition in South Africa? Or are these completely unrelated?
Well, Pik Botha was one of the most right-wing leaders the South African apartheid regime ever had, and it was because of rising pressure.
That's my point.
But ultimately, he was replaced by de Klerk, and that's what I think the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, aims to do with Israel. I think Israel's sort of in the Botha era.
Mm-hmm.
But you constantly hear these calls for a Palestinian Gandhi, and though we know that the Palestinian Gandhi is in a graveyard somewhere in Nablus, the Palestinian Gandhi is locked in an Israeli jail on a hunger strike, the Palestinian Gandhi is under too much pressure and stress and systematic violence to be able to make a difference from within. So the question is, where is the Israeli de Klerk? And that's what I would hope to see in the next phase, but that requires more momentum from BDS, and it requires the mainstreaming of BDS in the American political system.
We'll get into that in just a moment. More of tonight's Conversations with the Great Minds with Max Blumenthal right after the break. Welcome back to Conversations with Great Minds. I'm speaking with journalist and writer Max Blumenthal, author of the new book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Max, you mentioned in the last segment the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the BDS movement. What is this? Where did it come from? What's going on with it, and why has it got Israel freaked out?
The BDS movement is based on the boycott movement that contributed to the unraveling of the apartheid regime in South Africa and enabled South Africa to become a multiracial democratic state. And it embraces those goals in Israel-Palestine. And those goals couldn't be more urgent than at a time when the Israeli government and the state of Israel, which control all territory between the river and the sea through a matrix of domination, has scrapped the peace process and is intent on maintaining the occupation indefinitely. So I'm a supporter of the BDS movement because I think it's the only means of establishing external pressure and increasing it in order to produce an actual change on the ground. The BDS call was issued in 2005 after Israel built the separation wall in the West Bank, separating occupied East Jerusalem from the West Bank, cutting Palestinian villages off from themselves. The International Court of Justice ruled that wall illegal. And then the Palestinian Authority, which is basically an arm of the occupation or a subcontractor of the occupation, did absolutely nothing. And so all of these civil society groups from among Palestinian refugees, Palestinian women's groups, really that represented kind of a consensus of Palestinian opinion came together and said, we need an enforcement mechanism to enforce international law in Israel-Palestine. That's what the BDS call is based on. So there are three UN resolutions that BDS aims to enforce. The first one is Resolution 181, which Israel claims that it accepted the supposed partition plan, but which it never embraced because it calls for Palestinians inside Israel to be provided with equal rights. So equal rights for Palestinian citizens of Israel, which they currently don't have, and I can talk for the next hour about the apartheid conditions they face. The second one is Resolution 194, which ratifies the Palestinian right of return.
There are, UN resolution.
It's a UN resolution, and it was passed in 1949. Israel actually accepted it as a condition for its own acceptance to the UN General Assembly, and it has denied refugees any right to return to their homes and property that were expropriated inside Israel. And then the third one is Resolution 242, and this was issued after Israel took control of what are now known as the Palestinian Occupied Territories in 1967, and it calls for an end to the occupation. These are all things that I think any fair-minded person can accept, but they're things that Israel and its supporters describe as tantamount to the destruction of the state of Israel.
Well, what do you say to people who would say, okay, Israel's this Jewish state, and that was, you know, the land was basically taken from the Palestinians in the 40s, and has been incrementally, you know, that's been increasing over time. And so you've got a bunch of really pissed off Palestinians, and not just the Palestinians, a lot of Arabs around them also. And, you know, if you were to succeed with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and Israel was to say, okay, fine, we're going to become a pluralistic society, we're going to, you know, acknowledge everybody, and Jews are no longer a majority in Israel, there are those who suggest that the Palestinians and many of the other Arab countries and citizens around there would say, okay, time for revenge. We're just going to wipe them out.
Well, those are the kind of existential fears that animate the ruthlessness of Israeli society and the army that represents it. The fear that if they give up one inch, they'll be thrown into the sea, while fishermen in Gaza are not allowed to enter the sea.
Right, but isn't there some legitimacy to those fears?
I mean, there's always a legitimacy to a fear. If you're the bully and you have blood on your hands, every bully is terrified that he or she will face terrible retribution once they give up their power. And I think there needs to be international intervention and a reconciliation process to prevent that from happening. I mean, just from my time in Palestinian society, I've spent extensive time there. I don't hear the kind of opinions that Jewish Israelis fear. I don't hear them in Gaza. People just kind of in Palestinian society, the average person, they just want to be left alone. And they're being harassed and abused constantly, if not killed. So the source of the crisis is this ethnocratic state that you described. It's not because it's Jewish. If the Chinese had come and set up an ethnocratic state, there would be Sinophobic opinions among Palestinian society. And so when Israel becomes a democracy and incorporates Palestinians into its institutions as equals, those opinions weaken and dissipate. So that's what we're trying to get to. But you're right, it will be an Arab majority state,
which means it's no longer Israel.
It could be Israel. It could be Israel Palestine. It could be anything. It doesn't have to not be Israel. It doesn't have to give up the Jewish connection to Jerusalem. What it has to give up is the exclusivism and the racist institutions and structure. And if that's, and I think there's no excuse for holding millions of people hostage, for warehousing people in Gaza, for excluding millions of people in squalid camps throughout the world, just so you can maintain what Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister and defense minister, called a villa in the jungle, or what Theodor Herzl, the sort of intellectual godfather of Zionism, called a rampart against barbarism. The idea that you can establish a European outpost in the heart of the Middle East through force and violent demographic engineering is just fanciful, and it's what the source of the crisis is. So we have to move towards some kind of democratic reality to end the crisis. Now, there was recently a New Yorker article that I read about Donald Trump's supporters. It was written by someone who was profiling white nationalist leaders, and I've written extensively about white nationalism as well. And one of them was Jared Taylor. Jared Taylor is the leader of a group called American Renaissance. He believes that white people in the U.S. should establish an ethnically exclusive state of their own and be able to exclude others from it. And he says this isn't racist, it's just reality. And his fear is the demographic shifting of the U.S. And it's a fear that's been expressed by Donald Trump.
And Pat Buchanan wrote a book about it.
And Pat Buchanan wrote The Death of the West, which is actually originally going to be called The Death of Whitey until his white nationalist friend Sam Francis told him to change the title. And this is like, that book has influenced so many conservatives towards a white nationalist perspective. But in any case, what Jared Taylor was saying about the demographic shift in the U.S. and the fear of having a brown majority country is seen as anathema among almost all Americans except those within the far right. And these, you know, and it was obvious that the author of this piece was linking these opinions to Trump in order to show how extreme Trump is. But these opinions in Israel, that's the basis of the Jewish state. That is the basis of the maintenance of Israel in its current state. As an ethnocratic state, as an ethnocratic state that manipulates demographics. All of its policies are based on demographic engineering in order to keep the ethnic outcast, who happen to be the indigenous population, excluded, ghettoized, warehoused, or dispersed throughout the world. So it's unacceptable in the U.S., but we are the main supporters of it. And you and I and any liberal-minded person would be disgusted to hear another white person complain that black neighbors are moving into their neighborhood. But that is the basis of Zionism in its current phase.
Is keep the Arabs out. Keep.
This is for our ethno-religious group and nobody else. The goal is to maintain ethnically pure state.
But the United States, well, actually, I think you could probably make an argument that, and you and I talked about this last time we talked, that the United States in many ways was created as an ethnically pure state. It was even, you know, Catholics and Jews need not apply. It was just what, not just white and male, but Protestant as well. And that's obviously what the Pat Buchanan crowd wants to hang on to. But,
well, that's what they want to go back to. They always talk about taking back America.
Yeah,
that's like
yeah.
the essence of the Trump campaign, and
right.
that's, you know,
this is happening. I get it that it's absolutely racist, and it's happening all over the world. I mean, we're seeing in Northern European democracies the emergence of these right wing parties, and you know, Le Pen in France is probably one of the best known ones, in large part because of her father and whatnot. But you know, where they're saying, you know, our country is for our people, you know, Sweden for Swedes, Denmark for Danes, you know, why are we letting Syrians in here? Is that, how does a democracy make a transition? How does a democracy or a country maintain an identity as the nature of their people, their religion, their cultures change?
Well, you know, when you look at these far-right parties in Europe, part of their appeal is to a kind of a nostalgia for a past that never was, and a mythology for what European civilization has been. And Europe has never been civilized. Otherwise, I mean, I say that as a Jew. Any Jew should know that Europe was never civilized. And they're responsible for possibly the most appalling genocide in history, and this emerged from European nationalism. So the reemergence of European nationalism should be immediately rejected, along with its appeals to European and Western civilization. I'm with Gandhi. Western civilization, it would be a good idea. So you have a crisis in Europe, where Europe and the West has been involved. If not involved, it has been has orchestrated the destabilization of the Middle East, and now refugees are washing up on its shores. Mm. They have no means of handling this. There's no immigrant tradition in Europe. Their own self-image as democratic is being tested, and the far right is leveraging this to win at the polls, especially in local elections. And the whole narrative of the far right is moving into the mainstream, and it needs to be challenged. And it's a narrative about a fictional past in Europe that is actually extremely dangerous.
We'll continue this in just a moment. More of tonight's conversations with great minds with Max Blumenthal right after this break. And welcome back to Conversations with Great Minds. I'm speaking with journalist and writer Max Blumenthal, author of the new book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Max, in an earlier book of yours, Republican Gomorrah, you argued that the Republican Party has thrown away their big tent philosophy and they're just basically going with this nativist base. And you quote in your book a letter from former President Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower, in which he said, "Dictatorial systems make one contribution to their people, which leads them to tend to support such systems: freedom from the necessity of informing themselves and making up their own minds concerning these tremendous, complex, and difficult questions." I mean, Eisenhower was talking about McCarthyism, but doesn't this describe the modern-day Republican Party? And in some ways, doesn't this also describe U.S.-Israeli relations, at least at the level of policy discourse, which seems to have devolved to bumper sticker shouting matches?
Absolutely. Eisenhower was warning about the rise of the John Birch Society and about McCarthyism, something he was trying to keep out of the party in order to maintain its national with, you know, the transfer of Southern Democrats and Dixiecrats into the Republican Party through Barry Goldwater in the 64 campaign. That marked the, you know, failure of Eisenhower, the end of the Eisenhower era, if you will. In my book, Republican Gomorrah, which I published at the dawn of the Obama era, when I warned that Obama would come under siege from far-right elements and that he would roll over in the name of post-partisanship, and, you know, which has all borne itself out, and he would do massive damage to the progressive base. I tried to explain the kind of sensibility and the mentality of the people who comprise the Republican base, especially those in the Christian right. And so I drew on the work of Eric Fromm, who was a post-war psychologist. He wrote a book called Escape from Freedom, and the essence of his book, his thesis, was that if you fear freedom, if you can't stand alone in a very chaotic modern world, you will inevitably turn to fascism. Fromm identified the fascist follower, or the proto-fascist, as a sadomasochist. And that doesn't mean, you know, a sexual sadomasochist who's into kink, although some may be. What he was explaining was kind of a political sensibility in which the modern right-wing follower is sadistic in that they want to kick down the poor, the immigrants, those who are, you know, Muslims, welfare queens, and they need these moral panics to generate the energy to do so. And at the same time, they're masochistic. They need to bow down to a higher authority, whether that's, you know, the macho Jesus, Fabio from Nazareth, who populates so much of the modern literature of the Christian right, to, you know, George W. Bush at his height, to some megachurch pastor. And through the fusion of sadism and masochism, they achieve a release from the inner crisis that they were experiencing in the modern world, and they absorb themselves into this political culture. It's that kind of sensibility that Fox News is constantly appealing to, right, with reports about how awesome whatever right-wing figure of the day they're propping up. Whether it's Phil Robertson from the Duck Dynasty, the you know, martyr hero, victim hero, or Donald Trump or Sarah Palin, with, you know, images of black crime, Black Lives Matter being a radical threat. The sadomasochism is always present in right-wing media and in right-wing political culture. And right now, I think, I mean, you've seen wedge issues drive Republican campaigns. 2004, it was same-sex marriage. During the 90s, it was abortion. Now it's about Muslims and immigration, particularly Muslim immigrants. And that Islamophobia has taken over the right-wing militia movement. It's leading to these massive rallies outside mosques in Arizona, where men carry carry automatic weapons along with protest signs that are just abominably racist. But it's also featured at the highest level when you can, and you can see it on CNN. They'll let Donald Trump speak at any event for 1 hour, unedited, unexpurgated, and it's just pure vitriol against immigrants. He's calling for removing all undocumented immigrants from the U.S. All of them. I mean, imagine the kind of social catastrophe that will create, and it's also a plan that would cost $8 billion or more. But this is something that appeals, and it's something that Trump understands, even though he isn't from the Christian right. Even though he's just a businessman who could represent either party, but it's something that he understands is that sadomasochistic sensibilities at the core of the Republican base, and this base, while they only make up maybe 12 to 15% of the American population, is absolutely frenetic. They're constantly listening to right-wing radio, Fox News, right-wing media. They're hammering the yard signs for the Republican candidates. They're running for school board elections. They're taking over local town councils. And so they have a disproportionate impact that moderate Republicans, to the extent that they exist anymore, don't have, or that the average suburban swing voter, the soccer mom, doesn't have, because they actually have lives. These people's lives consist of constant frenetic political activity in a very radical right-wing vein in order to quell their inner crises.
Right. John Dean, in his book Conservatives Without a Conscience, refers to these folks as authoritarians.
Well, Josh Duggar's the perfect example.
Yeah, and says that there's basically two kinds of authoritarians. The vast majority of authoritarians are authoritarian followers. And then there's a small minority of authoritarians who are authoritarian leaders. And they can adapt themselves to pretty much any kind of political philosophy. That, you know, Joe Stalin was an authoritarian,
right,
quote, on the left, just like Mussolini was an authoritarian, quote, on the right. It doesn't matter. It's all authoritarianism.
Right.
How consequential is that a change in the Republican Party from the days of the 50s and 60s, the days of my dad's Republican Party, or maybe even before that? And how does that describe also the political nature of what's going on in Israel?
Well, the personal political sensibility of the right-wing authoritarian who is emblematic of the Republican base is crisis-afflicted. This is, as I said, Josh Duggar, the former head of the Family Research Council, which is the most powerful lobbying arm of the Christian right in Washington, who was spending time with a who's who of Republican presidential frontrunners until his sexual peccadilloes came to the fore, and really his hypocrisy came to the fore. It's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. He's a crisis-afflicted individual who's projecting his crises onto the Republican Party and altering the nature of the party itself, which, you know, is why we have people like Ted Cruz in the presidential race. It's also why Donald Trump is a front runner. So the party is irrevocably changed, and it will be unable to hold national power. It only holds power through gerrymandered congressional districts and through the senatorial system. And their strategy is to prevent as many people from voting as possible. What does that say about the party? Just like Israel, the Republican Party is facing a demographic crisis, and it's aiming to, obviously, they can't ethnically cleanse, although that's what Trump is essentially calling for doing. So they're stripping people of voting rights, and they have this whole moral panic about voter fraud. But that's what it really comes down to, is the inability of the party to hold power at the national level. Looking forward, you can imagine Texas becoming a purple and then a blue state because of demographic changes. Even Mississippi, young people are increasingly voting Democratic. Mississippi will move out of the red column, possibly, within the next 10 or 20 years. What's going to happen at the Republican National Convention if Trump holds strong? And the second figure is a surgeon named Ben Carson. He's not even a professional politician, and he's a right-wing fanatic as well. You could have a brokered convention where the Republican establishment tries to throw someone like Mitt Romney back into the ring. Romney's behind the scenes right now.
That's my prediction, actually.
And it's probably going to happen.
Yeah.
Romney, the face of the Republican establishment, and the party will just go, will tear itself apart if this happens. So I think this all, the personal is political in the Republican Party. And when you have crisis-afflicted individuals projecting their psychology onto the party, the party itself can't go anywhere but towards a massive crisis. They're lucky they have no serious opposition from the other side.
Well, the Democratic Party is going through its own crisis too, is it not? And isn't some of that tied into it's an existential crisis, but it's more of a insider outsider crisis. The party apparatchiks versus basically Bernie Sanders and the people that he represents.
Yeah, I mean, you can. I think like the media coverage of Hillary Clinton's been sort of unfair and ridiculous, but there's something deeper, and that's helped bring her numbers down. But there's something deeper there about what she really represents to the Democratic base. She represents the Clinton era, which was a time when the middle class was sold off, when NAFTA was passed, which has led to the immigration crisis, when the groundwork for the invasion of Iraq was laid, when the welfare system was destroyed.
The banks were
deregulated. We got rid of Glass-Steagall. So, you know, the Democratic base is very well informed. They're not the majority of Democratic voters, but we're talking about people who would self-identify as progressives. They're very well informed. They understood what the Clinton era meant for progressivism. The Obama administration has continued the process without interruption and filled its ranks with people like Rahm Emanuel, who's doing this at a local level in Chicago and facing massive opposition. And they're sick of it. You know, many of them have turned to the Sanders campaign. And I think it's unfortunate that Sanders can't make himself into a genuine anti-war candidate, because that would increase his cachet among progressives. But they're looking for some alternative to Clintonism, and they haven't been able to find it. And I think that's what the crisis that the Democratic Party faces that will play out at the convention, when Hillary Clinton will have to reinvent herself as some kind of new candidate. I don't know how she's going to be able to do so. So far, it's taken an apology tour from her husband, Bill Clinton, but that's not enough. I know she has some progressive instincts, at least on domestic policy, but she has to make those more clear. And for Bernie Sanders, I think his biggest problem right now is just name recognition.
Yeah, and a virtual media blackout. I mean,
absolutely. And actually, Trump has played a huge part in that.
Yeah.
Trump is hogging all the media, and some of that should go to Sanders.
Yeah, I'm with you. Max, great having you.
Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
To see this and other Conversations with Great Minds, go to our website at conversationswithgreatminds.com. And that's the big picture tonight. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You have been listening to A Conversation with journalist and author Max Blumenthal on Tom Hartman's radio program, Conversation with Great Minds.
The rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune to take.
If you can control about three or four key elements, you can totally own a state. You can make right wrong. You can make truth falsehood, falsehood truth. If you control the media, if you control the Justice Department, if you control the police, you own the system.
And you give me your best. You know,
obviously, the FBI was protecting something a lot more significant than a bunch of old pedophiles having improper relations with little boys. They were protecting something a lot more significant than a bunch of drug peddlers. They were protecting some very prominent politicians, powerful and wealthy individuals associated with those politicians and the political system, up to and including the highest political people in this entire country.
You're listening to episode 720 of Unwelcome Guests, The Conspiracy of Silence, VIP Defile, Blackmail, and the Deep State. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard two quotes from John DeCamp, who has done his best to try to expose the deep state's sexual exploitation and murder of children for its own deep political ends. Now, let me say right at the start, as usual, I have expurgated the language, so there are no FCC language violations. The episode itself was a pretty harrowing one to make. These are very distressing topics, so listener and broadcaster discretion is advised. One of the threads which connects the two videos I'm using in this episode, Embassy Row, is not gone into great detail, but the thought that of all the people one could blackmail, ambassadors of foreign governments are a particularly attractive target. If deep state groups could obtain material compromising those individuals, then this could be an effective tool of foreign policy. As I say, that's not expounded upon in the material. The blackmail element as a whole, in fact, is not emphasized, which is why I thought I would draw attention to it at this early stage. Now we begin with the soundtrack of a film, Spies, Lords and Predators, which was broadcast in Australia in a series called 60 Minutes, and credit goes to xronews.com for assisting in this production, which was broadcast earlier this year, 2015.
Without question, the biggest political scandal Britain has ever faced will be exposed tonight. It involves a secret network of the highest office holders in the land, past and current members of Parliament, cabinet ministers, judges, diplomats, even one of the country's top spies. These men are accused of some of the most sadistic child sexual abuse imaginable on hundreds of victims, some as young as 8. More confronting still are claims that children were killed in order to protect this network of predators, including one boy whose father worked at the Australian High Commission in London. For over 40 years, the evil child predators acted with complete impunity, hiding behind the facade of respectability. But no longer. They were children, often the most vulnerable, placed in the care of the state only to be betrayed, systematically trafficked to the most powerful men in the land. How many times were you raped?
Wow. Maybe twice, 3 times a week.
Boys and girls both farmed out to pedophiles like throwaway toys.
There would be a group of girls and a group of men, and the men would basically single out the girls.
Tonight, 3 victims speak out. Claims of a monumental cover-up. That children were murdered. One of them, the 15-year-old son of the Australian High Commissioner's chauffeur.
I just said to him that I think he's been taken by someone high up.
And what did that senior policeman say to you?
He said to me, you keep saying things like that, you could get hurt.
And the secret pedophile brotherhood, who to this day demand their right to have sex with children. What constitutes consent?
The willing involvement of a child. It's really quite simple.
A sex scandal at the very highest levels of the British establishment. Child sexual abuse victims come forward to point the finger at very powerful men. Serving members of the British Parliament, cabinet ministers, lords, spies, even senior police. Incriminated in a VIP pedophile ring for the privileged and powerful.
It happened to me, it happened to others, and why would it go on for so long? Why didn't somebody just step in and say, we need to investigate this?
Richard Kerr is now 54 and a clearly damage to man. His life began to fall apart when at the age of 9 he was sent to the now infamous Kincora Boys' Home in Northern Ireland, run by men who would later be convicted of the frequent rape of children in their care. How soon did the abuse start when you were sent there?
A week later, maybe.
Within a few years, Richard and other boys from the home were being trafficked around the country. You were brought across essentially to be playthings for pedophiles in England.
Boy toys. I felt afraid to say no. As long as I perform well, they said they'd take care of me.
So when you first came to London, Richard, what was the first place you were brought to?
The first place? I was taken to Dolphin Square.
Today, Richard Kerr is bringing us back to the place where he was taken to meet the men who ruled the country. An upmarket apartment complex called Dolphin Square, just minutes from the Houses of Parliament. What happened in here, Richard?
What happened in here? I was taken in here. I was told to sit down on the bed. And he started to take my clothes off.
Still hurts, doesn't it?
Of course it hurts. I've never forget. It hurts.
Richard was brought here to have sex with politicians and other high-ranking members of the British establishment, including members of the House of Lords. Are any of them still in the Parliament?
Yeah. Older, very old, lords.
Richard was one of dozens of boys and girls, almost all from state institutions, brought to the homes of the rich and powerful to be forced into sex with adults.
My soul at the time was being destroyed. And they took away everything I had.
British police are now investigating compelling evidence that dozens of children suffered similar fates.
I am Mr. Baker. I am age 11.
The happy smile hides a terrible secret. When this video was taken of 11-year-old Esther Baker, she had already been sexually abused for years. At the age of 6, a family member took you to other pedophiles, didn't they?
Yes. There would be a group of girls and a group of men, and the men would basically single out the girls, pick who they wanted, and then we'd be abused.
Raped?
Yeah. They did anything from molestation, which is touching and oral sex to full penetrative sex.
Esther, now 32, has identified 2 British politicians who were among her abusers in the early 1990s. The man I'm going to show you the photograph of is a Lord, a very senior politician. Have a look at this photograph and tell me if you recognise this person.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely clear that this is the man that sexually abused you? Over how many years?
over about 5-6 years.
And him?
Yeah.
So the photograph I'm showing you now is a person who until very recently, in fact the last election, was a fairly senior member of a political party in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
You're saying that that man abused you?
Yeah.
How can you be so sure? A lot of people might be watching this and thinking, well, she was a little girl. Maybe she's confused. Maybe she genuinely believes what she's saying, but she's confused. What do you say to that?
I'd say you don't forget those faces. No way.
They were powerful people. They were also people who very obviously had formed a group and enjoyed having sex with young children.
This man, we'll call Darren, was 15 and in a care home when he met Peter Wrighton, a senior advisor to the government on child development and secretly a member of the Pedophile Information Exchange, a group campaigning to lower the age of consent for child sex. In this home video, Wrighton can be seen grooming teenage boys, encouraging them to drink alcohol and engage in sexually suggestive behaviour. Wrighton would supply boys like Darren to VIPs at Dolphin Square.
We would be basically told who to go and talk to and what to do and with which person.
One of those men, also named by other witnesses we've spoken to, was Leon Britton, the former British Home Secretary. One of the most powerful men in the land, Leon Britton should have been prosecuting pedophiles. Instead, according to Darren and other witnesses, he was one of them.
He liked boys to dress in women's underwear and then to be in a room alone and discover you in women's underwear and punish you for wearing the underwear.
A member of Margaret Thatcher's cabinet?
Yes.
Raping children?
Yes.
Their stories may sound unbelievable, but their accounts of the abuse they suffered are being taken very seriously by British police and by a new generation of political leaders.
I think there has to be an element of cover-up or conspiracy, call it what you want.
Men like Conservative MP Zach Goldsmith.
If it's true, and the evidence suggests that it is,
yeah,
this is, isn't it, the biggest political scandal in British history?
I think that's right. I think there's very compelling evidence that very senior people engaged in terrible acts and were then protected by the establishment. I have no doubt at all about that, but I think the genie is out of the bottle.
Sadly, we'll probably never know just how many innocent children became victims of the pedophile gang operating at the highest reaches of the British establishment. Certainly, we know of dozens, if not hundreds, of state wards who were trafficked from institutions to be used as playthings of the rich and powerful. But others were literally picked out and abducted off the streets of London, including the teenage son of the chauffeur to the Australian High Commissioner. One of the great mysteries is a case now being reinvestigated by British police: the disappearance and almost certainly the murder of a 15-year-old boy named Martin Allen.
You smell a cover-up protecting the toffs, don't you?
I smell rats of the highest order.
Kevin Allen is Martin's brother. At the time Martin went missing, their father Tom was personal chauffeur to the Australian High Commissioner.
So this is the car that your dad drove?
Yeah.
With the number plate OZ1?
Yeah, AUS1.
One of the perks of their dad's job was a big house here in posh Kensington, right next to the High Commissioner's own residence.
What a beautiful, idyllic place for a young lad to grow up.
Yeah, this is where we lived.
But that happy life was about to be shattered. It's the 5th of November, 1979. 15-year-old Martin is heading home from school.
A witness tells police he sees Martin being led onto a train by a tall, blonde man in his 30s. He's holding Martin by the scruff of his neck, and the boy is clearly distressed. They only go one stop. They get off here at Earl's Court. And as they're heading out through the station, the man is overheard to say to Martin, "Don't try to run." The only problem is that witness only comes forward weeks later when he sees the boy's face on the TV news. And of course, by that time, it's too late. The trail's cold. And young Martin is never seen again. In the 36 years since your brother disappeared, has there ever been any leads, any information?
No.
Has his body ever been found?
No. No, it's lucky he was abducted by aliens.
The police investigation into Martin's disappearance was at best inept. One conversation with the officer in charge has stuck with Kevin.
I just said to him that I think he's been taken by someone high up in, I don't know, establishment, whether it's a businessman or an official of some sort.
And what did that senior policeman say to you?
He said to me, "You keep saying things like that, you could get hurt."
That sounds like a threat.
Well, I was like, almost fell off my chair at 17. But my mum and my dad and me, that was it. It was over with the police.
Now, police have reopened the case, also acknowledging they have credible evidence of murders committed by the Westminster paedophile ring.
These are children. These were children at the time, and they were abused because they were children, because he could get away with it.
Former policemen too, like Kelvin Ashby, are now revealing the extent of the cover-up. How their own investigations of politicians and government officials were stopped in their tracks on orders from above.
My immediate boss told me that the decision had been made higher up the chain.
Ashby was a detective inspector when he began investigating allegations that a prominent Labour MP, Greville Jenner, now a Lord, was sexually abusing a 12-year-old boy taken from a local children's home.
Did you want to arrest Jenner?
Yes, definitely.
Were you stopped from arresting Jenner?
Yes.
What was it about the boy's story that made you think it was credible?
Well, basically, he said that he'd been collected from the children's home many, many times.
By Jenner?
By Jenner, in his car. And that was... We backed that up.
Lord Jenner, who has denied all the allegations, has not yet been charged, but the Crown Prosecution Service has admitted it had enough evidence to prosecute Jenner all along for the sexual abuse of at least 9 children. But it may be too late. The very busy Baron Jenner of Braunstone now claims to be suffering from dementia.
And yet he's voted in the House of Lords on 203 occasions since he was diagnosed.
Yeah, and again, it's dual standards, isn't it?
So if he's good enough to vote, he's good enough to stand trial?
Yeah, it still sticks in the craw.
I was about to say, it still matters to you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
What's been going through your head?
What might have been, basically, for these kids' sake.
Have you ever met this man?
We asked Richard Kerr to identify his abusers from photographs.
What about this man?
Yes.
Okay, he's a former member of Parliament.
Yeah, I know. I mean, everybody, yes. Manchester. Cyril Smith? Or Smithy?
Cyril Smith was a prominent member of Parliament whose sexual abuse of children over a period of decades was so rampant that the Crown Prosecution Service has now formally admitted it was negligent in failing to prosecute him. Richard Kerr knew him intimately.
He's got a scar down there.
Did he rape you?
He didn't rape, we just had oral sex. He oral sexed me.
He was a notorious pedophile, wasn't he?
He was a hateful and snake. This man was a snake in the grass.
As we've uncovered tonight, the evil network of pedophiles included some of the most powerful and smartest minds in Britain. For years, they acted without fear of being caught, which was probably because one of their members was the second in charge of Britain's Secret Service. But the origins of their nefarious activities go back to a group called the Pedophile Information Exchange, or PIE, which in the early 1970s openly campaigned for the age of sexual consent to be lowered to 4. Now, be warned, you're about to meet a member of that group who unbelievably continues to say pedophilia is acceptable. Tell us what PI was all about, the Pedophile Information Exchange.
PI was an organisation for people who had a sexual attraction to children, and we thought our illegal interest in children ought to be made legal if it concerned relations with young people who were consenting to a relationship, if they were willingly involved.
Tom O'Carroll is a self-confessed, unrepentant pedophile and one of the founding members of the Pedophile Information Exchange. He now shies away from advocating the age of 4. Too easily misunderstood, he says.
The age of 4 came into it insofar as children by that age are normally verbal and can normally say whether they are liking a particular kind of activity or not.
You believe and advocate that it should be okay for an adult to have consenting sexual relations with a child aged 10, so long as it doesn't involve penetrative sex.
Well, the emphasis here is on consenting, the willing, free, uncoerced involvement of the child, yes.
And can I ask you this, though? Do you believe still that the majority of children at the age of 10 can communicate their consent to a sexual act?
Yes, I do, yes. I don't see that that is a problem, communicating their consent.
What constitutes consent?
The willing involvement of a child. It's really quite simple.
But how does one judge that?
That is a matter, as it is with adult consent, for the people involved.
Tom O'Carroll's self-serving views are a chilling insight into the mindset of the pedophiles who achieved positions of great power in British society. O'Carroll and 4 other members of PI were prosecuted and jailed in 1981, but a 6th member of the group was identified at the time only as Peter Henderson. He escaped prosecution.
OK, I've got another photograph to show you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know this man?
I know this man.
Who is he?
This Peter Hamey.
Did he have sex with you?
Yes, we had oral... Well, yes.
The pedophile who called himself Peter Henderson was, in fact, Sir Peter Telford Hayman, deputy head of the British Secret Service, MI6, one of the most powerful men in Britain. Hayman was caught with diaries full of sadistic sexual fantasies about children. But the spy chief was allowed to walk free.
He's the one who carried the brown book.
What was the brown book?
Like a brown diary. He put notes in it.
What, so he kept notes about what he'd done to you?
Maybe what I say. He had a brown, dark book. He carried it in his pocket.
For decades, powerful men like Haman were allowed to get away with their crimes. But even today, Tom O'Carroll argues he and other pedophiles should be allowed to have sex with children.
You keep saying, by the way, sex with children. It's not sex with children. It's sex, most people think, is sexual intercourse, penis in vagina, and a guy banging away until he gets orgasm. That's not what I mean by sex with children.
What are you talking
and
about?
I don't think we should talk in this sort of emotive fashion about sex with children.
What is a less emotive term?
Erotic contact with children.
And what would that involve?
Well, it might involve touching or masturbation.
In the warped view of the pedophile information exchange, the only harm caused by an adult having sex with a child occurs later, when the child is supposedly made to feel guilty about it.
If they were traumatised, they wouldn't have gone along.
You see, that's another lie that pedophiles spin.
What
they tell, they say that the kids aren't traumatised.
Wait a moment.
Believe me, they are traumatised, Tom.
Yes, but many years later, as a result of being told...
Why does that matter?
It matters because they would not have been traumatised but for being told that they had been abused.
So this is the point. You'd say that it's not the pedophile that's caused the abuse, it's the responsible authorities like the police
yes,
and their parents.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So you don't accept that having sex with a child can cause any kind of...
Let me tell you, we're getting peculiarly hysterical. Many years later, when people are told that they have been abused and it keeps being rammed into them from the media all the time, then that is the feeling they come to get. They come to think, I must be traumatised because people keep telling me so.
Okay,
That's how it happens.
Can I put to you, there's something in your book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a section in your book where you describe the scenario of a little girl sitting on a man's knee.
Yes.
And you describe approvingly how sexual relations with that little girl can be, quote, negotiated
mm-hmm.
by hints
yeah.
and signals,
mm-hmm.
such as complimenting her on her knickers
yeah.
and
yeah.
testing her response.
Yeah.
And what would be the adequate response from that little girl, Tom?
Enthusiasm.
What would that constitute? How would the little girl show you enthusiasm for you wanting to have sex with her?
Let's move away from...
No. Let's stick to this issue.
Well, all right, let's stick with the issue, but let me address it in my own way.
The little girl sitting on your knee, and you've just told her, I like your knickers.
Let me address it in my own way.
What does that little girl do to indicate that she's willing to consent to have sex with you, Tom?
How does somebody indicate willingness to have consent to anything?
A little girl cannot possibly be a consenting partner in that kind of power relationship. She's sitting on your knee, for God's sake.
Yes, she can.
You're an adult.
Yes, she can.
You use the term enthusiasm. What does that little girl do to indicate that she's enthusiastic?
I think that we're going round and round in circles.
No, what is the answer?
We're going round and round in circles. I've given you my answer multiple times, so I'll finish there.
Which is a non-answer. You just can't answer.
Well, you think it's a non-answer. I think it's an answer. All right.
Disgraceful secrets are only now coming to light. Men occupying some of the highest positions in the land, whose depraved crimes have scarred a generation of children. But for the victims of this scandal, for those who have lived their lives in pain, there is no walking away from this fight.
You realise it's going to boil down to the word of a woman 20 years on, remembering what happened to her when she was between the ages of 6 to 11 years old.
Yeah.
They're really going to go your credibility, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm ready for that because I've been very open about my life and everything that's gone on in my life. There's nothing that... I've got nothing to hide.
I'm lucky to survive, but I survived. Some of the others didn't. I'm the door that opens up everything.
And to those men who abused you, you are their worst nightmare. Yes. They're going to be lying in bed at night, worried that Richard Kerr's evidence is going to catch up with them.
They're going to get a knock on the door.
And we're going to hear now from Tim Tate, a documentary maker that lives in the southwest of England, and he tells the story of how his documentary on Republican child sexual abuse was made and then closed down, and how the victims ended up dead or doing decades in jail, while many of the US right-wing politicians just carried on in their political careers.
I'm Tim Tate. I'm a documentary filmmaker, investigative journalist and author of books, and I've been doing this for 30-something years for all British television networks and American networks, Al Jazeera, and books for a variety of publishers.
Can you just give us an idea of some of the films you've made that people might recognise, or books?
I worked with Roger Cook for 8 years, both in BBC Radio and then ITV's Cook Report. So this, people might recognise some of those. I've made films for Al Jazeera International, which I think probably has a footprint of about 250 million. So some people have seen those. It's investigative filmmaking. That's what I do. The last thing I made for Jazeera was an 8-part investigative series on 21st century slavery. So we were literally filming all around the world, investigating slavery, genuine slaves, people who are forced to work, get no pay and aren't allowed to leave. And there are 27 million of them in the world today.
Well, I've come to you today to talk about, particularly about this film, Conspiracy of Silence. Tell us what that film was about and how you came to make it.
The film tells the story of the alleged prostitution of young people, teenagers, firstly from America's favourite charity, Boys Town, which some people will remember from the Hollywood movies with Spencer Tracy. Boys Town is a real place in Nebraska. A freelance journalist with whom I'd worked brought me the story, allegations that children from Boys Town were being prostituted by a senior business and political figure in Nebraska, and further that he had prostituted those children, both from Boys Town and from across Nebraska. He'd taken them to be abused by people all over the states, and particularly in Washington, D.C., at what were described as parties with senior political figures.
So what was Boys Town?
Boys Town is, it's a town. It's an incorporated town in Nebraska. It was originally set up for homeless, impoverished or endangered children in the 1920s, I think, certainly 20s or early 30s. And it was a caring community. It was set up by the church, by a priest. And it was, its aim was to protect and to nurture and to help children in very difficult circumstances. And it has grown and grown and grown, so that, as I say, it is an incorporated town under American law. I think it has its own stamps now as well. It's a charity, and it has been described, and I believe it is, America's favourite charity. The problem was that in the 80s, this very powerful, influential figure, a man called Lawrence King, wormed his way into Boys Town and allegedly began prostituting children from it.
So what did you discover as part of the documentary? You say connections with Washington, D.C., but was it any specific party, any specific people in the main political parties in the U.S.?
That's going to be a complicated answer. There were two waves of allegations. The first happened in the late 1980s, when children from young people from Boys Town broke cover and made their allegations. By the time I got to the story, it was 3 or 4 years later, and those complainants had disappeared. I spent an awful long time trying to find them, and they had simply disappeared off the face of the earth. There was a second wave of allegations which had happened about a year previously, but from young people, three young people in particular, from Nebraska, not from Boys Town, but who had been involved with the prostitution of children from Boys Town as well as from the streets in Nebraska. And what they described were child sex parties in throughout Nebraska, but primarily in Omaha, and they also described being flown to Washington, D.C. to be abused at parties on what is known as Embassy Row, in houses along Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. So we're talking, and they were able to identify these houses to us, a very wealthy bit of real estate. They described politicians being present. In one case, there was an allegation of one of the most senior and famous American politicians of the time being present while a young boy was sexually abused. These three young people made their allegations. They made them first to the police and also to a commission of inquiry from the Nebraska State Senate, state government. What happened to those allegations and what happened to those young people was simply disgraceful.
What was the motive behind it then?
Behind the sexual abuse? What's the motive behind any sexual abuse?
Well, we were talking about this at the very highest political levels, though. So, you know, this does start to look like more like there's some kind of political motive, possibly.
I think you have to be a bit careful with that. What they were primarily describing was the sexual abuse of teenagers within rich and powerful circles in Nebraska. That happened to involve Nebraskan politicians, but local politicians, them being flown to Washington to take part in child sex or teenage sex parties in Washington, D.C. What was the motive? The presumed motive, or rather what they presumed one of the motives was for them being at those parties in Washington, D.C., was that it gave Lawrence King a great deal of leverage. This was almost exclusively within the Republican Party. Lawrence King was a rising star. He was the rising black star in the Republican Party at the time, and in fact sang the national anthem at the Republican National Convention, which is a huge honour for any aspiring politician.
Are there any senior politicians that were named as part of this investigation?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to name them because we didn't name the most senior ones in the film, because to do so, we would have required a great deal more than the evidence we had. But the victims of this abuse, and there's a little question but that they were abused, gave evidence in secret to a grand jury. Grand jury testimony is secret. And indeed, they also gave it in secret to a state Senate inquiry. I happened to get access to all of those files and read the names that they testified to. Without question, that should have led to a full investigation by the FBI. One of the things I found most disturbing, and my colleagues found most disturbing, is that rather than investigate, what the FBI was very plainly doing was trying to close the whole thing down.
You mentioned that some of the witnesses and the victims disappeared, and you found some other ones. It does sort of imply that there's some threats and attempts to close down the investigation one way or another. Did you notice when you were making the documentary, did you find there was any attempt to intimidate you out of doing it, that sort of thing?
Yeah, without question. We were followed by what we believed and were led to believe was the FBI. Our cars were followed. Now, I think if anyone who knows anything about this knows that if you're being followed professionally, you're not going to know about it. Someone was, I think, quite clearly trying to send us a message that we were not welcome in Nebraska. We were there. I was there for a total of 3 months dealing with this. And it was made very plain that we were under observation. No one ever threatened me. for which I'm very glad. That said, some of the witnesses were absolutely intimidated. Two in particular. From the first wave, there was a young woman, very young woman, early, mid-teens. And by the time I tracked her down, and she was one I did track down, three or four years later, she was mid to late teens. It took an awful long time to find her. When I did find her, I literally turned up at her doorstep one evening. She confirmed who she was. She said, yes, she knew what I was talking about, but she was looking around constant. She was very, very plainly frightened and said, would I come back the next day? By the time I got back the next day, the house was empty. I never found her again. From the second wave, there was a young man called Troy Bonner, and if people see the film, they will see him in it. Troy had made allegations and had corroborated the allegations of the two other main complainants. Troy was a troubled young man. He had a serious drug problem, which had not been helped by his involvement in child sex parties. When I found him, he was terrified. He had originally given his evidence. He had then been threatened, so he said, by the FBI to withdraw that evidence and had recanted. So by the time I found him, he was in a pretty tricky state. I wasn't about to take his word for it that he had been threatened by the FBI or pressured by the FBI, but I found an audio recording in these files, which were locked up and kept secret. I found an audio recording made by the FBI in which the FBI introduced themselves. It's an audio recording of Troy ringing up one of the other complainants and trying to get her to admit that she had made up the story. She was incredulous and saying, what are you talking about? Why are you doing this? And Troy, in this recorded phone call, was just about losing it, saying, I can't tell you, you just got to say this didn't happen. And at one point she says, is there someone there with you? Are the police there with you? No. Now, at the very front of the recording, the police, the FBI, had introduced themselves. This is a recording made by the FBI with Troy Bonner. He was terrified, and he said he'd been threatened by the FBI that if he didn't recant, he would go to prison. As a very severe drug addict, he was worried by that. I spent weeks with Troy, and I persuaded him in the end that it would be better if he told the truth. And that once he'd told the truth, there was no mileage in anyone doing anything to him. And he did. He agreed. And he recanted his recantation and told the truth about all of it on film. And my promise to him had been that once you've done that and once the film's broadcast, you'll be safe. The film, as people may know, was never broadcast. Troy disappeared, and a year later he was found dead.
Well, there's echoes there of the recordings made by Liz McKean for Newsnight of the victims of Jimmy Savile. She went back to her boss, I think it's Peter Rippon at Newsnight, the BBC here in Britain, and she was told, well, there's a Jimmy Savile special coming up at Christmas, and I'm afraid we won't be able to broadcast. So, well, how does that affect you as a programme maker when you, after, you know, maybe days, weeks, months even of getting someone to go on camera, you're then told by your bosses and the people that own the transmitters and that kind of thing that, oh, we're never going to show this?
I felt then, and I still feel now, at least partially responsible for Troy's death. You know, Troy's death was, as I understand it, the result of a drug overdose. That in itself is no great surprise. He was, as he made plain, addicted to heroin and crack. He also said that if things went wrong, he would be found dead of a drug overdose and it wouldn't be him. Was it him? Did he accidentally take an overdose? Did he commit suicide or was it something else? I don't know, but I do know that the reassurance I had given him and which persuaded him to tell the truth didn't happen.
So what have you learnt since you made that documentary, and what's happened to some of the victims and some of the perpetrators of abuse in Omaha?
I think it's probably worth rehearsing what happened to the film. The film was... I was then working for Yorkshire Television's documentaries department, and it was the best place in Britain and probably the world to make serious documentaries, to make serious films. Yorkshire Television had done a deal with Discovery, the US and European-based cable company, to make a series of documentaries on its, which would be broadcast on Discovery. And Discovery had leapt at the proposal for our film, Conspiracy of Silence. I can remember the commissioning editor rubbing her hands and saying, it's got everything. It's got politics, it's got paedophilia, it's got everything we want. And they gave us the money to go and make it. And we spent, as I say, I spent 3 months in Nebraska, on and off, and other places, making this film. Everything was shot on 16mm film, which is a phenomenally expensive way of making documentaries. And we brought all the material back to Britain, to Yorkshire, to cut the film. And we assembled a rough cut of the film, which is the normal way of doing things. And that rough cut, my colleague, who was the director, I was the producer, my colleague took that rough cut over to Washington, D.C. to show it, as you would normally do, to Discovery, who were paying for it. In the meantime, my job was to show it to the lawyers and to work with the lawyers to get it into a shape where it was legally okay to transmit it. Yorkshire Television, under the its contract with Discovery, had legal responsibility for doing that. It was our responsibility to get a legal clean bill of health for the film so it could be broadcast. And we had very good lawyers, media lawyers in London, Goodman Derrick, and a very high-powered firm of media lawyers in New York. They went over it, and I showed them the evidence, and both sets of lawyers gave the film a clean bill of health. It was good to go legally. By the time that had happened, Nick, my colleague, the director, had had his meeting with Discovery, who liked the rough cut, but who then, subsequently, turned round and cancelled the film. And I remember, to this day, him ringing me, Nick, my colleague, ringing me in shell-shocked, saying, I've just come out of a meeting, they say they won't broadcast the film. And I asked what the reason was, and this was what he was told, and I quote, "We seem to have gotten into an investigative area which is inconsistent with Discovery's mission statement." Now, you read into that whatever you want to read into that. But Discovery was adamant. I mean, the film was actually in the listings, television listings magazines. It was scheduled. They simply pulled out. They refused to discuss it any further. Eventually, the film was handed back to Yorkshire Television. The rights to it were handed back to Yorkshire Television, with Discovery paying all the substantial costs of making it to date, and Yorkshire given the right to do whatever it wanted to do with it, to get it broadcast elsewhere if it wanted to, on the condition that no one ever associated Discovery with the film.
Now that's interesting, because surely it would have made sense for Yorkshire to get it broadcast in Britain.
Yeah, I thought that. We were, as you might imagine, pretty shell-shocked, but I began trying to find alternative networks to broadcast this. And in fact, I had a couple of approaches from distributors who wanted to fund the remaining work, and it didn't, I mean, it needed to be finished, it was a rough cut, and to broadcast it or to blow it up to 35mm for a cinema feature documentary. The man who was then running the documentaries department at Yorkshire Television just didn't want to know.
What's your thoughts about what was behind that then? And I wonder if anybody who was from Discovery or from the networks here in Britain, because, I mean, it did touch on some very key and very powerful politicians, isn't it? One would like to think that they're not actually above the law and not above having documentaries made about them, these key political figures.
I think there are a number of answers to that. The film was exclusively American. It was about a situation, a case, a series of allegations, a scandal in the United States. There was no part of the film which touched on Britain. British networks, would they then, would they now have been interested? My guess is probably not. They tend to be quite parochial, and they're not really interested in films which don't have a British angle. This didn't. This was specifically an American film. And in the rest of the United States, I can't think of a single US network, be it cable, be it mainstream television, which would go near this. They don't want to do investigative journalism.
But why not? I mean, I'm a bit annoyed because you've done all your work. You found out that it's illegally okay to show. At least, you know, that's what the lawyers are indicating. So how does it work that, you know, powerful people get programs like this, as it seems, shut down?
That's a very good question. And if I knew the answer to that, possibly I wouldn't be making films, but I would be a politician. I simply don't know the answer. What I can tell you is that Lawrence King, the central figure in this, the man about whom most of the allegations were made and on whom they centred, went to prison for 15 years for fraud. He was unquestionably a fraudster, amongst other things. But if you contrast that with what happened to one of the victims, a young woman called Alicia Owens. She'd been in the second wave. By the time I arrived, Alicia had been hung out to dry by the courts in Nebraska. She had been required in court testimony to name her abusers. She had done so, and she was thereafter prosecuted for perjury. And she was given a sentence of between 9 and 27 years in prison for naming her abuser. Firstly, that's a tell to me. That's an enormous sentence for perjury. But what was even more worrying was she was tried in Nebraska state court in Nebraska, and under Nebraska state law, specifically provided not just protection for naming your alleged abuser, but actually made it a legal requirement. So Alicia was jailed for this huge sentence under a law which didn't exist.
We've had recently the Jimmy Savile scandal, which actually in some ways many people think may never have seen the light of day if it hadn't been for some dogged attempts to get that story out. And I just wonder if you think the child sexual abuse inquiry that's currently going on, at least there's an attempt to get this child sexual abuse inquiry done by the Home Office, whether you think that we're ever going to get to the bottom of that when we don't have these this backstop of the investigative documentaries. Can we really rely on statutory bodies like the Home Office, the courts, to get to the bottom of what really went on?
No, is the simple answer. For my sins or otherwise, I have spent 25 years making films and writing books about what adults do to children, primarily child sexual abuse, and the loose, disorganised networks of paedophiles. And there are men who have been to prison because of the work that I was funded to do. But I've worked with a number of police units and departments over the years. All of them have told and continue to tell exactly the same story. We are not given enough resources to do this job. We don't have the manpower. We don't have the trained officers. And the decision not to give them that is a political decision with a small p. Someone has said this is not sufficiently a priority. Two small examples. I made a film and wrote a book with a man called Ray Wire, who was then the best expert at dealing with men who abused children. And it was about Britain's, what was then Britain's worst child sex serial killer, who's serving a succession of life sentences now. He should have been picked up long before he was. No one had bothered communicating to anybody else his records. But most worryingly, when I went to what was then called the National Criminal Intelligence Service, which has now been superseded by the National Crime Agency, Britain's FBI, effectively, 2 years after he was sentenced, his name was not on their database. And there was a reason for that. And the reason for that was that they had been given, assigned, NCIS had been assigned, 1.5 officers to work on child sexual abuse, paedophile intelligence, whilst in the next office there were 11 officers doing exactly the same job for football hooliganism. Somebody has said football hooliganism is a priority, child sexual abuse isn't. All right, that's 15, 20 years ago. Has it changed? No, it hasn't. I wrote a story for one of the Nationals earlier on this year about a man who had been arrested in Lancashire. The National Crime Agency had been tipped off by the Russian Interior Ministry that this man was trading child pornography via a Russian-based peer-to-peer network. It was a fantastic piece of cooperation from the Russian Interior Ministry. The National Crime Agency farmed this investigation out to Lancashire Police, where the man lived. They raided him. They couldn't find the film he had been trading, but they found other material, one of which was, according to the police, according to the prosecution in the subsequent trial, and according to the judge in that trial, the first snuff child pornography film that had ever been seized. It was a teenage girl shown being sexually abused, tied up and suffocated, and then lying dead. Her face and the offender's face were quite visible on this film. That film was seized 16 months before I got involved in the case. It should have been sent by Lancashire Police to the National Crime Agency, who should have checked with their facial recognition software. They are under an international treaty, binding international treaty, to send that material to law enforcement worldwide, particularly to the United States, which has the best facial recognition software, and particularly because the girl, the victim, and the perpetrator in this were American. They had American accents. 16 months after that tape was seized, it was still sitting in Lancashire Police. No one had done anything with it. We don't assign a priority to this. It doesn't matter, apparently. I think it matters. And I do not understand why we don't do this properly.
Well, don't you think there's a sort of psychology around this, that because it's something that people recoil from, and they will maybe switch the TV off if they see something like this on the TV, it's actually something which actually aids the perpetrators, that?
Documentaries about child sexual abuse, and indeed books about them, are some of the hardest things ever to get commissioned. And it is true that a significant number of people will refuse to watch. I think that's asking the wrong question. I don't really mind if 100 people watch this or 1 million people watch this. Our job is to do the work and to show it, and somehow to get as many people as will watch it to watch it. But more than that, doing what we do is the essential watchdog on the police, on the government, on the courts. If we don't, as journalists, be the dog that barks, who the hell will?
And thanks to Tony Gosling for that interview, which was from November 2014. Now, as we've heard, Tim Tate was exasperated with the fact that his film was bought, paid for, and then basically thrown away. And it may well have been that somebody just pulled the plug when they heard that these revelations were about to be aired. Of course, it is also possible
for the Money No Object Deep State gang to say, let's find somebody good to collect a lot of that evidence, put it in one place, and then we can go through and neutralize it. That seems to have been more or less what has happened. Unpersuaded by that evidence, with Wikipedia, that guardian of the internet's official narrative, has a single very modest page entitled Franklin Child Prostitution Ring Allegations, treats the whole thing as some kind of very unproven hoax perpetrated for unclear reasons by people deserving of being locked up for perjury. Now, if you improve the Wikipedia page, well then great, except it's subject to control by the powers that be. If you'd rather work on an independent collection of the available evidence, I've started a page, Franklin Child Prostitution Ring, which is pretty empty at the moment, but notes some of the suspicious deaths associated with it and fits a larger pattern. You can join me on Wikispooks, that's wikispooks.com, an encyclopedia devoted to the deep state, which we've been gathering a lot of material, such as the stuff I've been airing on earlier Unwelcome Guests episodes. Now, what better way to close the show than with the soundtrack of the said film, Conspiracy of Silence? Was never broadcast on television, but a rough cut has found its way onto the internet. So let's hear the soundtrack of that now.
A Republican from the Midwest, Lawrence E. King, is serving a 15-year prison sentence for a multi-million dollar fraud. But financial crime is only half the story. This is the true story of Lawrence King. It is the story of an evil at the heart of America, of a cover-up at the highest level. One man is attempting to uncover the full story. John DeCamp is among the most highly decorated Vietnam veterans. A former Republican state senator in Lincoln, Nebraska, he is now a lawyer fighting the legacy of Lawrence King's evil network.
It's a web of intrigue that starts in our holy of holies, Boys Town, Nebraska, one of the most respected institutions in the United States, and spreads out like a spider web through Washington, D.C., right up to the steps of the nation's capital, the steps of the White House, involves some of the most respected and powerful and richest businessmen in this United States of America. And the centerpiece of the entire web is the use of children for sex and drug dealing and drug couriers, the compromising of politicians, the compromising of businessmen, but worst of all, the corruption of key institutions of government that have the duty and responsibility to make sure these things never happen.
World-famed Boys Town is in the news again.
Made famous by an Oscar-winning film, Boys Town, Nebraska is America's favorite children's charity. It was founded in 1917 by Father Edward Flanagan.
The saddest spectacle in our social life is the neglected, unwanted, and unloved boy who has become a serious problem in our society.
Boys Town was started to be a home for orphans. That was after World War One, and since then society has changed and the problems of boys have changed, and so now it's a question of taking care of homeless, abandoned, neglected, abused boys, and now girls also.
With cash reserves of $500 million, Boys Town is the richest square mile in the world. It has been granted the privileges of an incorporated town, a Catholic diocese, and a school district for 500 boys and girls. One-third of its annual income is raised from public donations, solicited by begging letters and promotional videos.
I'm Father Val Peter, the caretaker of Father Flanagan's dream and the executive director of Boys Town. Does Boys Town really exist, people ask me? You bet it does.
Located in the heartland of America, Boys Town youth have come from many backgrounds and locales. As they graduate, they shall seek new adventures and head for different places. But always, They shall carry with them the spirit of Boys Town. If you'd like to help Boys Town, send your tax-deductible gift to Father Val Peter, Boys Town, Nebraska, 68010.
Boys Town, for me, was the first thing I ever heard of. When you think of institutions that you respect, believe it or not, I was there for a while when I was a young boy. Probably worldwide, there's no institution other than Boys Town that has done so much good for so many children over such a long period of time so successfully. When an institution like that gets contaminated for purposes of abusing children instead of protecting children, then you better, if you've got any decency at all, do something about it, or at least get it cleared up.
John DeCamp lays the blame for the contamination of Boys Town on the one-time leader of the National Black Republican Council, Larry King.
Larry King was the fastest rising black star in the entire Republican Party of the United States during all of the 1980s. And he was also one of the most evil individuals in this country in terms of being a dealer of children, in terms of being a thief, $40 million that they documented he stole, and in terms of using and compromising and corrupting one after another politicians.
The base for his network was a small people's bank in Omaha, Nebraska, the Franklin Federal Credit Union. Larry King was its general manager.
Thank you. This is especially an exciting day for me.
Mr. King was a very charismatic person. When he came to the credit union, he was brought in because the credit union was actually failing. He did everything to build the credit union.
King courted the leaders of Omaha's wealthy business district. Banks, industry, and charities placed millions of dollars in King's hands. From 1979, Larry King developed close commercial ties to Boys Town, and Boys Town youngsters were sent to work for his companies.
Boys Town had quite a few accounts at Franklin Credit Union. Those were considered very valuable accounts. They were handled exclusively by the bookkeeping department. But on the average of once a month or once every 2 months, we always seemed to incorporate a person from Boys Town.
King used Boys Town as a source of young boys for his business and for sex and drug orgies. Paul Banassi was a victim of King's abuse. He was also sent by King to lure Boys Town youngsters off campus.
We used to just drive around, go up to a home, and we used to do some of the scavenger hunts with picking up some of the kids. You know, just kind of win their confidence, become friends with them for a while. Start inviting them to the parties. The kids were 10 years old or older.
In 1986, King's plundering of Boys Town was reported by staff to the chief executive, Father Val Peter. Subsequent testimony proves that he carried out his own investigation, but that King's victims refused to talk.
Nebraska has a very clear statute that child abuse allegations should be reported to authorities. They shouldn't be reported to the principal of the school, director of a facility. They should be reported directly to either Child Protective Services or law enforcement. An internal investigation at Boys Town would have no status. I mean, in other words, that evidence collected may be something that could augment, but it certainly could not take the place of an investigation, a criminal investigation.
Could you understand why a very detailed report from a social worker employed at Boys Town, identifying children and identifying their alleged abusers, never saw the light of day? Nothing happened with that.
No, I can understand that, because had I known that, I wouldn't put up with that. But is that something like that happened? I don't know. Well, in retrospect, I regret having any association with Larry King. Had I known it at the time, it would never have happened.
Despite the investigation, Larry King remained free to feed his pedophilic parties with child victims. But in 1988, a routine review brought the Boys Town cases to the attention of Nebraska's State Foster Care Review Board.
And the information presented to the Foster Care Review Board, either via the telephone reports, the personal reports, or the reports we reviewed, Larry King's name was consistently present as someone that the youth were making allegations against. I mean, I turned that information over to authorities, and nothing happened. I would say we handed over at least a foot-high amount of material. Generally speaking, the allegations were ignored.
Omaha police now accept that Larry King may have been abusing children.
Good morning, Roberta.
Good morning, Steve.
But its most senior detective claims he never received any evidence.
It is certainly possible that Mr. King was involved in illegal acts with children. If there was sufficient evidence of those types of allegations, he would have been prosecuted by the county attorney's office.
For me, it was very clear that the case was not investigated and not pursued because of the alleged perpetrators.
Those perpetrators named by the children formed a ring of rich and powerful pedophiles in Omaha. Men from industry, politics, the media, even the police. Besides Larry King, ringleaders were department store billionaire Alan Bear, and the celebrity columnist of the Omaha World Herald newspaper, Peter Citron. With the judicial system apparently paralyzed, Larry King's political and business empire grew. He courted the Republican Party nationally and plundered Franklin's accounts to finance a luxury lifestyle of limousines, private planes, and palatial homes, three in Omaha and one in Washington, D.C. Franklin's records show he spent $10 million on jewelry, flowers, and private planes. And his lavish spending bought him a charmed life.
Larry King was constantly heralded, cheered, applauded in the news media as the great businessman that's helping the poor people, the black community of Omaha.
But King's extravagance attracted the attention of the Internal Revenue Service. As a result, on April the 11th, 1988, the Franklin Credit Union was raided and closed by the FBI. King was arrested, and a federal investigation showed he'd stolen $40 million from Franklin. But the FBI's inquiries were secret, and evidence of King's sex ring was quickly covered up. In November 1988, Nebraska's state government set up a parallel investigation into the Franklin financial collapse. A legislative committee was formed. Its chairman was the Republican head of Nebraska's banking committee, corn farmer and state senator Lawrence Schmidt. But the money trail led quickly to the original allegations of child abuse, and almost immediately anonymous threats began.
I received a phone call on the floor of the legislature. The caller did not identify himself, but he said, "Lauren, you do not want to have an investigation of the Franklin Federal Credit Union." And I asked who I was speaking to, and they said, "That doesn't matter, but you shouldn't have that investigation." And I said, "Well, why not?" He said, "It will reach to the highest levels of the Republican Party, and we're both good Republicans."
The night before we testified before the legislative committee, I did receive a phone call at home that said, "If you speak, you won't live to regret it."
Undeterred, Schmidt's committee hired professional investigators Karen Ormiston and Gary Caradori.
When we hired Mr. Caradori, I was very specific to him. I said, "We do not want you to bring to the committee rumors, innuendos, nothing that cannot be backed up with facts." I said, "Bring to the committee that which we can take to a prosecutor."
On the streets of Omaha, Gary Caradori and Karen Ormiston found new victims of King's pedophile network. Every new youngster told the same stories as those from Boys Town, covered up 3 years earlier.
They were telling us about prominent people in Omaha and elsewhere that were abusing children at parties.
The prominent citizens' names that originally came up were of concern to me because I knew many of those individuals, and I very frankly was shocked to have those names show up on the list.
Ormiston and Caradori recorded their new witnesses on videotape. A victim of abuse since he was 8, Paul Vanassi was present at many of Larry King's sex parties.
Who were some of these people that would come to these parties? Larry King, King's sexual was involved. He was like that.
Media personality Peter Citron procured some of his victims from Boys Town.
The kids he liked were mainly around the age of about 8 and 13. It was mainly fondling and oral sex with him. He did have some anal sex, but he usually did that with the older kids.
But Citron's abuse of Paul Vanassi involved ever more sadistic parties.
He was like, tied me up and had some other kids perform sex on me, and then he would use
cigarettes. Okay, just take a deep breath. Whenever you were tied up, was there anybody else present other than you, Peter Citron, and Danny King?
Yes.
Who was that?
It was Alan Burris, the Chinese. Larry King. All my love. And Charles McCoy.
Troy Bonner would tie you up?
Troy Bonner was 17 when he was introduced to the paedophile parties by Alan Bear.
He lifted me up and moved me over the bed to lift me on the bed and put his head down, started performing oral sex on me while his penis was at my end.
As they say, a 59 position.
Alan Bear was a sick fuck. Didn't care, you know, wanted sex, nasty, you know, I don't even know if you can call it sex, you know, and take it any way he can get it, pay for it, he'd like to, but if he had to take it by force, he would. Larry King was the same kind of sick fuck Alan Bear was, except Larry King was more violent, more sure of himself, you know. I mean, I would, you know, see him fuck a 10-year-old boy in the ass, you know, until he bled, and, you know, just pull out and stop, and, you know, push him down, you know, and then go out and, you know, meet with decent people.
King would also provide underage girls for abuse. Alicia Rowan was 15 when she attended her first party.
I met some guys there that were from Boys Town, and it was at that party that I met Larry King. At the time that I met Larry King, I did not know that he was Larry King. I had met him. It was the first time I'd ever met him.
Alan Bear and Larry King frequently hosted the child sex parties in penthouse apartments at the Twin Towers luxury block.
A lot of it was me handcuffed with my hands behind my head and my feet tied and doing different things. Sometimes it'd be a guy straddling over my face.
Okay.
Most of the time, Larry King took pictures quite a bit during that time.
I know it's difficult.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe they could say no.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay. And you know, Alicia, you're a victim. Mm-hmm. And at the young age, just go off camera for a minute.
We were appalled. Appalled. It was incredible. It's incredible what these kids went through, I think.
I was shocked when I walked in. There was a kid, I would say, about 15 years old, out in the middle of the room. One guy was standing in front of him. He was bent over, and the other guy was, like, reaching under him, playing with his nipples, while a guy whom Jeff told me was a police officer shoving beads up his rectum.
The police officer was shoving beads up his rectum?
Yes.
Everything, I mean, from just, you know, touching to, you know, fruit, squash, you know, huge squash, you know, that big around, you know, stuck into you, into your ass, you know. Heat things, hot things, you know, poked at you and stuck in you, you know. I got those scars on my arm one night at a party where Larry King was, and he had brought somebody, I don't clearly remember who it was. You know, wanted to see how strong a man we were or something, you know, and have us push our arms together. And you push your arms together. King has these same scars. And you push them tight together, and then you light cigarettes, and as soon as you get burning, you just drop them down between your arms and, you know, let it burn. You know, and they made us stand there naked and touch each other by holding our arms together and burn cigarettes. Where, you know, it's on film someplace. I mean, they filmed it burning, you know.
And those of us that didn't like to be involved and didn't want to be involved were threatened.
Who did he threaten
and what? Larry King.
Did Larry King personally do?
And I think she did. And they threatened, you know, that I can go find somebody that will kill you and it will kill your family. You didn't tell anybody.
Larry King was also here. He came in and we drank and did cocaine. I didn't do much. He turned me on to Larry King.
He didn't like me because, you know, I would get high on drugs, you know, and I would question him about, you know, how can you do that? I mean, once I asked him, you know, he wanted me to shit on him, urinate on him, you know, and I did, but gladly, you know, I mean, you know, I even said to him, you know, you stupid f***er, you know, I mean, I just shit on your pay me money, how can you get into that, you know, and I got, you know, beat up by it. I came home here a lot of times, beat the shit from, you know, misspeaking my tongue, so to speak, and, you know, just telling him how I felt sometimes.
Drugs was a strong part of how they got control of some of the kids, because that's what some of the kids were there to get. They would do the sexual acts and then be provided with cocaine or whatever type of drug they wanted.
Heroin, you know, I don't know, but that was my drug of choice, you know. Till this day, I remain an addict, you know.
Larry King was, I would say, the center of transporting the children around the country. The airplanes were usually, at least in his name, they were paid for by Larry King.
We met them in Pasadena.
Met who in Pasadena?
We met Larry King was there. There was three boys that I had seen at one of the receptions at the country club were there, and I'm most positive they were Boys Town boys. Almost positive. They were there.
You mean graduates of Boys Town? Well, not present.
I didn't do a present because they were young.
Well, how would they get away so often?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Boys Town came up frequently during the investigation, but we found it very difficult to get information about Boys Town. I was not able to find any information on my visit there, and Mr. Caradore could not get information either.
Four years on, Boys Town remains unwilling to discuss its involvement with Larry King. We asked for an interview with Chief Executive Father Val Peter, but Boys Town's public affairs officer refused.
I would have to give you a flat no. I'm just going to tell you at this point that we will not participate with you. We have no interest in talking to you folks. It's something that we don't even care to delve into.
Hi.
Hi, is Father Val Peter available, please?
You can check in his office. It's the first one on the...
Thank you very much. We're here because we have to give Father Val Peter and Boys Town every opportunity to talk to us about the very serious allegations.
Turn your recorder off. Please step outside.
Why is it that Boys Town is unwilling to discuss your relationship with Larry King?
We don't have a relationship with
him. I'm afraid papers that we possess show that Boys Town had a relationship with Larry King.
I just suggest you be very careful about what you report. Excuse me. I'll let you leave.
By the spring of 1989, so serious were the child abuse allegations before the Franklin Committee that its chairman, Lauren Schmidt, sought the advice of his lawyer, John DeCamp. He told Schmidt to turn over all the evidence to the FBI. Immediately, the videotaped testimony was leaked to a hostile media.
The media immediately started discrediting the witnesses. They were... The witnesses came across in the media, in the Omaha World Herald, especially, as the criminals.
The last three victim witnesses were demolished by the press, particularly the Omaha World Herald. The paper never looked for information that would support any of the allegations. The whole purpose of the stories was to destroy any credibility that these youth may have.
I've heard that people said that Gary Caradore coached me and that he told me what to say, but the fact was I didn't meet Gary Caradore until way after I'd already talked to the Omaha police about the abuse and had named all the same people, and they didn't ask me very much about Larry King or even Alan Bear at all. They treated the allegations that I made about the people who abused me almost like a joke.
The information did not come our way. It was given, as I said, to the FBI and Nebraska State Patrol. They conducted their own investigations of the information. The stories were of such significance that the investigators first wanted to prove the accuracy of the stories. As they said about the investigation of the three, initially three and then a fourth person who were telling the stories, as the investigation developed, it became obvious to the investigators that the information was not accurate, that in fact, it was an entire conspiracy of allegations, none of which had any truth to them.
I was very disappointed with the way the FBI and law enforcement treated the victims. They, in fact, turned them into the offenders, so to speak. And instead of taking the evidence that was delivered to them by the victims and interrogating the persons whom the victims identified, they seemed to bear down and try to get the victims to change their story.
Troy Bonner was brought in for questioning by the FBI.
The FBI's attitude was, you know, just no, that these kind of things don't happen. From the first interview when I went, you know, and realized they don't believe a f***ing thing I'm saying, you know, I mean, they were just appalled, but I realized what that look in their eye was back then. It was fear. It was fear of every, you know. I mean, I had witnessed, you know, firsthand things that would, you know, destroy this city. You know, people, a position, you know what I mean? It's not going to be believed, they said. It will not be believed. You will be found guilty of perjury. And you, I mean, they weren't telling me maybe. You know, they were saying, there's no way. You go on with this story, you're going to jail. I mean, that was said to me direct. Just out of fear, I came to recant the story out of fear.
Troy Bonner agreed to recant his videotaped testimony and state instead that his evidence had been invented. Next, the FBI used Troy in an attempt to trap Alicia Owen into recanting her evidence about Larry King's ring of powerful pedophiles. The phone call, recorded by the FBI on March the 9th, 1990, proves conclusive evidence for John DeCamp.
This is Special Agent Michael F. Mott. The following will be a consensually recorded telephone call between Troy Bonner and Alicia Owen.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Hey, what's going on?
I'd like to ask you that.
Talk to me.
No, you talk to me. I don't understand what you're lying. Why are you lying?
What are you talking about?
That's what I'm asking.
You're calling me why I'm lying?
Yeah.
You can talk to this whole thing, Alicia.
You little s***.
You either tell me what's going on. Hey, look. I had nobody listening to me. I'm listening to you, and I'm hoping you give me some answers.
I'll be honest with you. I'm the one who
I'm not trying to play a game.
And I don't know how...
You're being stupid, Alicia. I'm not going to go to jail for you. And that's what's going to happen.
Why would you go to jail? Jail for telling the truth?
No, jail for lying.
What have you lied about?
I haven't lied.
Okay, but why are...
Listen, shut up. Listen to me. You're not out here being talked to him every day. The pressure's kind of hard.
You literally have to have bricks for brains to take on the FBI in this country. And that's exactly what you'd have to do this properly. They now, in my opinion, in my investigation, are the architects of the cover-up.
We asked the FBI for an interview about its investigation of the Franklin scandal.
Larry Holmquist with the FBI here. We feel it would be inappropriate for us to comment. We work this with the Omaha Police Department. We just don't feel it would be appropriate for us to make comments.
As Gary Caradori and Karen Ormiston sought out new witnesses on the streets of Omaha, they found themselves under constant threat.
Gary was threatened several times. His vehicles were tampered with. I would think whoever tampered with them, it was a scare tactic because it was so obvious that they were being tampered with.
Gary got, there was one piece of evidence I know he got that he was, that he even said he got one step ahead of him this time. He told us about this book because it was like addresses, telephone numbers, names. He said if they knew you had it, they'd kill him.
On July the 11th, 1990, Gary Caradori and his 8-year-old son, AJ, were flying home from Chicago. They had watched the All-Stars baseball game, and Caradori had been pursuing new leads.
Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board are in Harold Cameron's cornfield, trying to determine what caused this private plane to crash, killing its two occupants.
The bodies of Gary Caradori and 8-year-old AJ were found in the wreckage.
National Transportation Safety Board investigators say wreckage from the crash is apparently strewn over a three-quarter to one-mile-long stretch in this field.
The fact that the wreckage is scattered over a large area certainly demonstrates that it did break up in flight. The exact mechanism of breakup yet is still unknown.
The federal investigation was never able to discover what tore the plane apart.
There are things missing from the plane. His briefcase is missing. Again, we'll never know what all was missing because I don't know what he had with him. I don't know what he did in Chicago. He may have had information he was coming back with.
Within 24 hours of the tragedy, FBI agents impounded all records of the investigation. Gary's widow, Sandy, is still unable to come to terms with her loss.
As a mother, I don't want to ever think that somebody murdered my child, let alone my husband. But I think if you'd ever talk to any parent, be it mother or father, who's ever lost a child, I mean, the worst thing that you can think of is that somebody would want to murder a child.
I really feel that somebody killed my brother, and inside me, I know that somebody killed my brother. If somebody could help us out somewhere, somebody knows something, and may God help those who did that to him and his family.
Gary Caradori's death pricked Troy Bonner's conscience. He promised Sandy that he would recant his recantation and tell the truth.
I set the record straight. I was, you know, going to do it. And would, you know, the truth would come out, you know, and somebody would be held accountable for his death. And then at the funeral I had seen, you know, FBI guys, you know, and they looked at me. You know, I was supposed to meet Senator Obetz and Schmidt for lunch after the funeral. And you know, that's when I decided, I told my mom, you know, we're not going to do the launch. We're going to hightail it out of Lincoln now.
The effect of Gary's crash on the investigation, I think, in effect, put an end to anybody else coming forward with sensitive information like this.
That's when I was finished, because I figured out if they murdered Gary and his son, there was nothing that would stop them. There was no piece of paper, there was nothing we could come up with that was going to get anything done.
Under pressure from the FBI, Troy Bonner agreed to tell a Douglas County grand jury investigating Larry King that he and Alicia Owen had concocted the entire child abuse story on payment of a $500 bond. Troy Bonner was to be the star witness against Alicia Owen, but he grew uneasy about maintaining what he claims were the lies fed to him by the FBI. But when his brother Sean died in an inexplicable gun accident, Troy and his family were convinced they'd been sent a warning message.
You know, and they killed him just flat outright, somehow, professionally, made something happen, you know, to shut me up.
The purpose of Sean's death? To instill fear? And it worked.
Do I feel guilty about my brother? Yes, I do. That's where all this is coming from. This is where the energy, that's where the energy is coming from, that I'm getting to do this. Is for him, because, I mean, it should have been me there instead of him. Really. I mean, I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad, but I mean, he was brilliant and, you know, innocent. You know, it should have been me. I mean, he had so much to give. I've taken so much. You know, it should have been the other way around.
I can explain to you what it feels like to lose a child. But when you see the pain your kids have because of that, it's much worse. I can't do anything for them. I can't take that pain away from them.
Lauren Schmidt's legislative committee issued a report denouncing the grand jury. 2 months later, it was disbanded, leaving Schmidt a broken man.
The message was not lost on most politicians in Nebraska. I think the message that was delivered was, if any legislative committee ever tries to conduct a thorough investigation again, the same thing will happen. It has shaken my faith in the institutions of government. I used to be a firm believer that the system would work, and that people who did things wrong would be punished. And we discovered victims who claimed to have been abused and who the grand jury acknowledged had been abused. But they did not try to find out who had abused those individuals. Instead, they convicted Alicia Owen of perjury. Indefensible from my point of view.
In July 1991, Alicia Owen was convicted of perjury. Her sentence was between 9 and 25 years.
I can't find a case in the history of this country where some kid got sentenced to 25 or 30 years in prison for something like this. If you were going to pick a what I call a tell sign, something that says something fishy about the whole thing, it was in the sentencing itself. For some reason, they had to send a signal to every kid who was a potential witness. My opinion again. A signal so loud and clear, if you dare to come forward, if you dare to talk, watch what happens.
3 months later, Larry King was jailed for the $40 million fraud. He was given a 15-year sentence, 10 years less than Alicia Owen. John DeCamp is now the only man fighting to help Larry King's victims. He has become the lawyer for Paul Bonassi and Alicia Owen.
I live in Nebraska. Hell, I was born here, raised here. I have four kids growing up here. Like it or not, it's my heritage, you know? Well, if it's a dirty cesspool,
that I got to live in or look back on that I left, that ain't good. The real cost, if I were going to say to my family, has been the fear and intimidation that's put in some of the kids. A couple of the kids are really, really frightened and really had some sleeping problems over, you know, here, this or that. So that's been the real concern I've had.
In the face of mysterious threats, John has turned for advice to his friend and one-time boss, former head of the CIA, Bill Colby.
Old Bill Colby told me better than anything. The one thing that the bad people can't afford is publicity, and knocking you off right now or doing something obvious to one of your kids would bring them more trouble than it's worth.
I said, you have to consider the possibility of some danger to not only your reputation, but to your person. I mean, there are... People do react rather violently to some kinds of charges, or particularly if they're true, there's more apt to be a negative reaction than if they're false. If they're false charges, then they can be reacted to in a normal way, by a libel suit or whatever. But if there's truth in it, there can be a danger in that situation. We've seen that happen in other cases.
John DeCamp has arranged to meet Troy Bonner, the young man he sees as the key to the cover-up.
He's in great danger. The reason is he carries the secret, so to speak. He served his purpose for the FBI and others by committing the lies that put the seal on the cover-up. His greatest safety probably lies in doing exactly what he knows he should do, that is, exposing the whole thing, taking one final last chance and telling the truth.
My fears are that, you know, I'm not going to be believed again. It's just, you know, going to be a whole other kind of exploitation like it was last time. You know, and afraid that that's going to happen, or, you know, I might end up dead. Or a loved one might end up dead again. I want this to go forward and have something done so that all those other kids who are a lot worse, more worse things have happened to can... come forward and see that action can be taken, because there are a lot of other kids out there that, you know, things happen to them that, you know, a lot worse than happened to me.
You have to, if you want to protect yourself and your life and your family's life, both now and particularly in the future, is to use the institutions of government that have been set up to protect you and make them work. That means you go into federal court. You go after the people that have done this cover-up, and you expose it so there's no longer any percentage on their part in eliminating you, because the secret's out.
That's why we're here today, to let it out.
I have no doubt that he's now telling the truth, number one, and number two, that he originally told the truth. Potentially, they could decide to charge him with perjury, because now he is telling that they forced me to lie. I did lie at Alicia's trial. I did lie before the grand jury. I did it because the authorities were forcing me to do it, and I was scared for my family. My brother had been killed when I tried to back out the one time. Potentially, they could charge him with perjury this time.
Alicia Rowan is out of prison and on bail, while DeCamp appeals against her perjury conviction. As he prepares for a court hearing, new evidence of the cover-up emerges. And once again, it involves Troy Bonner's evidence.
The tapes that were shown to the grand jury had been edited. Everything that matched Troy's statement
was shown.
That matched mine.
Because I know it's
was edited out. And I think maybe one of the things we want to do is show the judge specifically how, where these, you know, little 5-minute segments of, look, this tape says this, and then show him it isn't in this tape, and this is the tape the grand jury saw.
I'm going to attempt to get these tapes, and we'll see what happens next.
But to obtain the evidence, DeCamp must approach some of the very officials he believes were involved in the cover-up, the county attorney's office which ran the grand jury.
In the good old Alicia Owen case, 127-194, I'm trying to get the evidence, the tapes and the transcripts of Troy and Danny, Troy Bonner.
It might be downstairs.
We'll get that up. Yeah. I think there's two tapes. There should be, as I understand, and the transcript of them. But if I could get them, I could start reviewing them and figure out
maybe a little bit on what's happening on some things.
Up at the county attorney, they have all the bills up there.
Oh.
Robert,
let me guess, Robert Siegler has them.
Robert Siegler is the prosecuting attorney fighting to send Alicia Owen back to prison. After lengthy negotiations, the camp emerges with the tapes the grand jury never saw.
How much was $4,000, about $4,000 of cocaine.
Okay, and what airline?
I flew out of American.
Okay, and did you go direct?
No, I had to stop over in Denver. No, it was a stopover in Dallas Fort Worth.
So you went from where to where to where?
I went from Omaha to Dallas Fort Worth, like an hour, and then a big plane from Dallas to Los Angeles.
Right. Did anybody go with you?
Alicia Owen.
If this indeed were left out of the grand jury proceedings, then I am totally shocked and angry beyond words. Here it is, so to speak, the smoking gun that they could go out and verify, the corroboration, in other words, the linkage to King that was denied. Cover-up. Organized, planned, deliberate cover-up.
The courthouse, Wahoo, Nebraska. The hearings begin. Alicia Owen is ready to testify. So too is Paul Benassi. But there is no sign of Troy Bonner. DeCamp discovers that Robert Siegler has sent the young man a threatening subpoena. Fearing arrest for perjury, Troy has gone into hiding.
Let's try and subpoena him before these guys. Is Troy okay?
Yeah, he's okay.
I'm just not going to have any testimony for him if he does. Okay, Troy's not here. Where's Alicia?
No.
In court, DeCamp successfully pleads for another adjournment. The county attorney's office begins to search for Troy Bonner, but Robert Siegler won't say why.
I'll ask you whether you're about to charge Troy Bonner with perjury.
Oh, no.
Why isn't Bonner calling, Mr. Siegler? You're a public official, aren't you? Mr. Siegler, is it true you are about to charge Troy Bonner with perjury?
No, I haven't.
Mr. Siegler, if you do not charge Troy Bonner with perjury, does that mean you accept what he's saying is true?
No, I haven't.
Why are you trying to have Troy Bonner summoned to this hearing, Mr. Siegler?
No, I haven't.
Why no comment, Mr. Siegler?
No comment.
Every victim witness who stepped forward in any way, or even was a potential witness that somebody heard about, has either been killed, put in jail under some theory or other, terrified or run out of the state, discredited. Every perpetrator, even the convicted ones, have been treated as conquering heroes. Obviously, the FBI was protecting something a lot more significant than a bunch of old pedophiles having improper relations with little boys. They were protecting something a lot more significant than a bunch of drug peddlers. They were protecting, in my opinion, they were protecting some very prominent politicians, some very powerful and wealthy individuals associated with those politicians and the political system, up to and including the highest political people in this entire country.
In search of answers, John DeCamp goes to Washington to investigate Larry King's powerful connections in the nation's capital. Paul Benassi has come too. Larry King threw child sex parties at his $5,000 a month Washington house. Paul Benassi was one of the victims.
Larry King's house down in Washington, D.C. was a nice house. It was on what I believe it was Embassy Row, because that's what they kept talking about. There were a lot of flags from different countries when you drove around in the area.
So tell me, Paul, how often did you come here?
I was about 14, about 1981, and at first it was about 3 or 4 times the first year. After that, it was about once a month after 81.
And who brought you here?
Larry King brought me here.
And this is the actual house where you...
Yes.
And what, you were used for sex then?
Yes. Some of the parties, when they started off, were straight political-type parties with no sex. And then when some of the men had left, some of the politicians had left, the ones that had planned, they had planned on engaging in some type of sexual activity, that would come after the party. Some of the kids would be held downstairs in some of the rooms where if they acted up or if they started freaking out because of the drugs that they were on, they'd put them in a room that they couldn't get out of and they'd lock them in.
Were there drugs at these parties?
Yes.
What kind of drugs?
Anything you wanted. Cocaine, heroin, speedballs.
You're telling me those things were at these parties where you had Larry King and prominent politicians?
Yes.
Were they readily available to anybody at the party?
They, at the after parties, they were readily available for anybody. Beforehand, they did it more upstairs than they did anywhere else, and it's kind of in the back rooms.
Were any attempts ever made that you know of to expose this situation?
As far as I know, nothing's ever been done, and most of the people that were in there had already been, I guess you'd say, compromised.
King's partner in sex crime was powerful Washington lobbyist Craig Spence. He took youngsters like Bonassi on midnight tours of the White House.
So you were in the White House then?
Yes.
And how did you gain access?
Well, I came down with Larry King, but Craig Spence was the one that arranged the trip for us. And it was kind of a gift for our services that we were doing.
How many times were you on this kind of a trip?
I came to it on two times.
Two times? And were you used for sex on those occasions?
Not until after we left.
After you left the White House?
Yes.
What time of night?
It was usually around midnight. To me, it was just kind of weird being in the White House at that time of the night, and getting to go into places that the guy was telling us that nobody gets to go to. I mean, I've seen rooms in there that I'd never even heard about. And Craig Spence and Larry King had a couple of groups. One was called Bodies by God, and they had the Callboys, and there was another group that was started by Larry King, which was called the Golden Boys, which was kids that were usually under the age of approximately 10.
On the trail of Craig Spence, DeCamp finds the investigative reporter who exposed Spence's callboy network, Paul Rodriguez of the Washington Times.
We had uncovered a series of allegations from some minors, and it led me to a callboy operation here in Washington.
It sure fits with, you know, this boy Paul Bonassi. And he tells a tale of being brought to the White House on occasion, kind of as a reward for the kid.
Craig Spence is dead. He committed suicide. He had advanced stages of AIDS. He was an AIDS carrier, and he killed himself. This was the thing that always bothered me. They claimed it was the largest male prostitution ring in the city that they've ever had uncovered. It was $1 million a year minimum.
Yeah.
And yet they only prosecuted the operator, Henry Vinson, and three of his lieutenants, as it were. Mm-hmm. They never went after any of the Johns or the clients. This operation, which was, again, quite large, claimed to have clients that ran from the White House to the Capitol Hill to the State House to the churches within the media.
And that's precisely what Paul describes as the people he was with.
And a lot of the stuff led there, but we couldn't quite nail it at all cases because, again, to accuse someone of high stature, you've got to be very careful.
I understand.
We were able to do it through the mother lode, which provided us credit card receipts and canceled checks, and then lists of the clients. The prosecutors knew all this stuff. There was approximately 20,000 pieces of or 20,000 documents that they had. They sealed the entire record when they found out I was accessing it. They required consent agreements from all the lawyers, all the clients, all the relatives of all the clients, all the hookers, including the clients themselves.
Which means you can never gain access.
They sealed them by court order. And we've attempted on several occasions to unseal that, and we've been told it'll be a cold day in hell before those records ever get unsealed. And it makes me wonder what's in those records.
Yeah.
The Attorney General is now involved. Bill Colby has passed DeCamp's evidence to a senior lawyer in the Justice Department.
He did say that the Attorney General's office would be very sensitive to any charges of abuse of children. that this was a matter of considerable priority to the department, that this sort of thing not take place, and that they would assign an officer to look into the case.
For John DeCamp, the story of Larry King's corrupt empire holds a dire warning for America.
If you can control about three or four key elements, you can totally own a state, you can make right wrong, you can make truth falsehood, falsehood truth. If you control the media, if you control the Justice Department, if you control the police, you own the system.
It's beyond belief that arguably the most powerful person in the world, the President of the United States, in the form of Richard Nixon, could not prevent the investigation of Watergate, or that President Reagan could not prevent the investigation of Iran-Contra. And yet somehow this group of unnamed, unknown, anonymous individuals in Omaha, Nebraska have such power they can control and protect all of these people from being investigated. Those allegations are ridiculous.
Well, first of all, Nixon did cover up Watergate, number one. Bush did cover up Iran-Contra, at least officially. And Omaha has successfully covered up this situation. In each case, it was the press that exposed the problem. It wasn't institutions of government. They had been corrupted. They had been compromised. They were the ones doing the cover-up. The Justice Department, acting through FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Omaha, emerges from the record of the Franklin investigation, not so much as a party to the cover-up, but as its coordinator. Rigging grand juries, harassment of witnesses, incitement to perjury, and tampering with evidence, federal personnel were seen to apply all those techniques in the Franklin case.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you have a clear reading voice and would like to contribute material, you may contact me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net, to volunteer your services. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Like an unwelcome guest.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Marilyn Waring on Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. This film was a secret favorite for those who wanted to decode the economic system of perpetual destructive growth, and for those who looked for an intelligent explanation of the connection between economics and war. Now, finally, it has become accessible on the Internet on the website of the National Film Board of Canada at www.nfb.ca. Look under Marilyn Waring, the real star of the documentary by Terry Nash. Marilyn Waring was only 22 when she was first elected to the New Zealand Parliament. Re-elected three times, she soon became chair of the prestigious Public Expenditures Committee, the sole Budget, Appropriations, Public Accounts Committee of Parliament. She was shocked and dismayed when she learned that all countries that are members of the United Nations, practically the whole world, are forced to keep their books and design their budgets under the system of national income accounting, which records monetary transactions as gross domestic product. Marilyn Waring said in part one that the GDP system counts only cash transactions in the market. In other words, it recognizes no value other than money. This means there is no value to peace, to the preservation of the environment, and no value to unpaid work. The system leaves out half the population of the planet and the planet itself, she says. This segment begins with war. Under the GDP accounting system, war is the biggest growth industry of all. When John Maynard Keynes and Richard Stone invented the GDP formula during World War II, they explicitly designed it as a system of how to pay for the war, end quote. This British system was imposed on the world in 1953. No country may be a member of the UN, deal with the IMF, or World Bank unless they do their national accounting based on the GDP. And some say that unlimited growth along with globalization has driven the wars and environmental destruction of the past 50-plus years. In spite of the magnitude of the problem with growth and GDP accounting, there is an encouraging aspect. If a global system can be designed by two economists, Mr. Keynes and Mr. Stone, and if it can get imposed not so long ago, in 1953, it is possible and necessary to design a different system and set a date for change in the near future. Here is Marilyn Waring in the soundtrack of the film about her, Who's Counting? Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. After addressing the issue of war, she presents some of her ideas for a replacement system to the GDP.
The international trade in arms is the biggest growth industry of all.
They scout aircraft for acquiring targets at day or night, work in desert storm.
The five permanent members of the Security Council are also the five leading arms exporters in the world.
Out beyond 10 kilometers, mass-mounted sight.
Killing people, or preparing to kill them, is considered very valuable in the international economic system. Arms exports account for more than half the trade surplus of the developed economies. But the death, homelessness, injury, poverty and starvation caused by the use of these weapons is not even registered as a deficit.
If a country develops an economic system that is based on how to pay for the war, and if the amounts of fixed capital investment that are apparent are tied up in armaments, and if that country is a major exporter of arms and its industrial fabric is dependent on them, then it would be in that country's interests to ensure that it always had a market. It is not an exaggeration to say that it is clearly in the interests of the world's leading arms exporters to make sure that there is always a war going on somewhere.
Every minute, 30 children die from want of food and inexpensive vaccines. And every minute, the world's military budget absorbs $1.3 million of the public treasury. This is war. The United States now devotes over $200 billion a year to military defense against foreign enemies. But 45% of Americans are afraid to go out alone at night within 1 mile of their homes. This is war. For every 100,000 people in the world, there are 556 soldiers, but only 85 doctors. This is war. For every soldier, the average world military expenditure is $22,000. For every school-aged child, the average public education expenditure is $380. This is war. The cost of a single new nuclear submarine equals the annual education budget of 23 developing countries with 160 million school-aged children. This is war. War is marketable. War pays, literally. War contributes to growth and development. The Philippines can be seen as a microcosm of the entire developing world. These are the hills overlooking the port city of Cebu in the southern part of the Philippines. It's a rural area which has been left vacant by an absentee landowner. A group of families have moved onto this land and built their huts and established a community here. Most of the men only get sporadic jobs, or they provide cheap labour for some of the large cash crop plantations around the country. So it's really up to the women themselves to provide for the children. The average Filipino woman has 8 children to raise and no access to abortion, family planning, or divorce. You can imagine the anxiety that a mother of 8 must feel if she doesn't know where she's going to get enough food to feed them all every day. This is the reason that women in rural areas all over the world grow food crops or raise farm animals. This sort of farming is usually called subsistence agriculture. It doesn't involve the exchange of money, but it does ensure that these children will eat. The system of national accounts says that the domestic and personal services which don't count are the cleaning, decoration, and maintenance of the dwelling occupied by the household, the cleaning, servicing and repair of household goods, the care of the sick, infirm or old people, the transportation of members of the household or their goods, the preparation and serving of meals, the care, training and instruction of children. The World Bank would argue that to change the conditions of life for these people requires export growth, to make room for productive exporting enterprises. These unproductive women and their families would simply be kicked off the land. The new company could then take further advantage of the homelessness it had helped to create by getting cheap labor here. The number of homeless children in the urban squalor of developing countries is now epidemic in its proportions. The cycle of poverty begins to repeat itself very early, as the eldest girl in a family at age 8 or 9 is expected to give up school and look after her youngest siblings, while her mother uses that time to do whatever she can to keep her family alive. Older boys may be left to fend for themselves and to sleep in the streets. Jennifer and Renren are 10-year-olds. They're just 2 of the children available through this Japanese brochure, which sells men-only tourist junkets to the Philippines. Recent studies in Thailand, which also has a lucrative business in female sexual slavery, have shown that 70% of the women and girls have become infected with the HIV virus. Those who sexually exploit children are counted as doing productive work, increasing economic growth. Even if their activities are illegal,
They're considered valuable enough to be in the calculations because they're income generating. Female sexual slavery is a major growth industry worldwide. And where a multi-million dollar industry in prostitution is operating, full advantage is taken of this grinding poverty. Foreign-owned companies and a small Filipino elite own 90% of the land. In a country of 58 million people, 20 million are now homeless. Thanks to multinational monocrop plantations, the Philippines is the 14th largest exporter of food in the world. And yet 80% of the children who live here can't get enough to eat. Over 1 billion people on the planet are malnourished. In the developing countries, 50,000 people a day die from malnutrition. Seventeen million children in the world die each year from diseases that are related to poverty. Two-thirds of these deaths are preventable. The gross domestic product claims to measure the well-being of a country. When my friends Imelda and Loris harvest New Zealand seafood for their families, it isn't seen as economically valuable. But if they went and bought the oysters in tins at the supermarket, then that would be counted.
Before the Europeans come on, the Maoris never ever had electricity and things like that. So their food mainly depended on from the sea, was gathered from the sea. We have a custom that's called Kai Moana. Its meaning is gathering of food, mainly shellfish, from the sea. We go out when it's the tide's low and pick up seafood, mussels, oysters. The oysters take about 2 to 3 years to grow, so that's why you just take a little bit.
Yeah, we only usually take enough food for a meal, you know.
Then if you're still hungry in a couple of days, you come back and get another bucket full, and then you have them fresh all the time.
But we never sell it. The old Maoris don't sell shell food. It's not meant to be. It's meant, you know, they...
Give it away, you never ever sell it. You get the odd one who'll take it back to the cities to sell, but the elders usually come down hard on them and say, it's costing you nothing, and if you come and take a whole lot of food from here, then the next person that comes along to get some can't find it because you're taking it all away and selling it for money. You should leave it for food.
Well, if I'm going down to a beach to collect Kai Moana, I always behave the way that I've been taught by the local people, by the Maori people. And I find in this and in so many of the practices in Aotearoa, in New Zealand, that they make perfect sense. I mean, both perfect economic sense, perfect environmental sense, perfect ecological sense, from, you know, centuries of tradition of indigenous people. So why change it? Why behave any other way? I certainly feel in this entire journey that my constituents and then women and the ecosystem has been my teachers. Very early when I was a member of parliament, there was an application made for a prospecting license on Mount Porongia by a company called Gold Mines New Zealand. And the planning procedure was such that the mining company could show all the apparent good that was going to accrue to all of this area.
We'll provide loads of jobs. We'll provide loads of support to the service infrastructures. You know, your schools will stay open. You'll get more roading. Your post offices, all of those kinds of services, your electricians and plumbers and everybody else will have loads of jobs while we're involved in all of this. There'll be export earnings. It's gold we're talking about. There'll be substantial reductions in overseas funds. You know, we'll be here for years. Yeah, the usual growth development kinds of arguments. No debit side, you notice. There's never any debit side in terms of this kind of development. Nobody talking about what you're going to do with all the materials that you take out of the mountain that then begin to leach into surrounding farmland. The kind of scarring that would be happening in the bush and the forest and the mountains, the ruin of the habitat of so many species.
Colin Murray was a party official in my constituency and a key member of the local farmers' organisation working against the gold mine licence.
It's a fascinating mountain because it's different every day. A little bit of cloud behind it. It was a volcano originally. It also plays a big part in our lives because it affects the weather so much. We have 90-inch rainfall here, which makes this area so good for dairying and farming generally. And that's brought about to a very, very large extent by Mount Porongia. The water around here, I have a lovely stream through the farm across the road there, and the water, the tests that the Waikato Regional Authority have done on the water, it's amongst the purest water in the country. And that's just something you can't put a value on.
Economics is a tool of people in power. I mean, economics didn't just come up from nowhere. It's a tool of those who want to exploit. It's a justification. And so as a so-called science, it doesn't allow for the introduction of values that don't find their way into a mathematical formula. It also operates in terms of language. You know, if you want to argue that mining this mountain would be devastating, you are invited to use a whole lot of words that are called soft, you know, flaky, value-laden, subjective. Economics has got it down really tight, you know, so that if you're not talking their language, if you're not talking in their jargon, you're not part of the argument, you know. So the power of economics mirrors to a great extent, you know, the political power rampant anywhere else. The economic activity that the mountain is engaged in is like 24 hours a day, never ending. It's the habitat for the pollinating species, without which none of this agriculture could survive. It's controlling the microclimate for the production that comes from everything out here. It's breathing, I mean, it's creating oxygen. None of those features can find a very easy expression in terms of cost-benefit analysis. I mean, you can't run around and say, oh, well, so much oxygen is being produced from these trees on a 24-hour basis, and the same volume of oxygen in containers in a hospital would equal, and therefore the 24-hour oxygen production of this mountain equals. Who's going to do that? This entire story so early in my political years demonstrated to me the absolute hollowness of the mathematical formula that we have to work with.
There was a tremendous uproar from the locals and plenty of meetings, well attended, and with Marilyn Waring's help we managed to block the miners, so that's not going to take place now. It's a forest reserve now. It's all that bush-clad mountain is reserved as a forest park. This here, this farming that you can see all around you, is here forever. it's not going to go away, and we're producing something far more valuable than gold. We're producing food and clothing for people, wool and so on. And, you know, mankind can do without gold, but you can't last long without food. You know, that was our argument, and I think it's the argument. This goes on forever if we look after it. It's ours for a short time while we're here on Earth. But someone else has then got to take over. And providing we look after it, it should get better and better.
It was just a local story, you know, in my constituency. But I think as an analogy, it can be expanded to the whole planet.
But what are we after then? What are the alternatives? Your country, Canada, or mine, New Zealand, where there are political will, could establish qualitative environmental indicators. Indicators that told us what was happening to water quality, air quality, the remaining stands of forest, the exploitation of mineral resources, the reproduction of fish species, the habitats of endangered species. There is no reason why tomorrow Canada or New Zealand could not establish time use surveys, because the one common denominator that all of us have, the one thing we might be said to choose to exchange, that is our own, is time. And time is a better description of the needs for intervention in people's lives than any other indicator. It shows you where the crisis points are. It shows you where the service needs are as a policymaker. In a study conducted by the Commission on the Status of Women in Canada, it was demonstrated that 2/3 of all primary health care took place in the home. If 2/3 of the budget for primary health care were directed towards those responsible for that care, imagine what would happen to that budget, and how that budget would be redistributed, and how the priorities would be turned on their head. These are the kinds of effects, in a budgetary sense, that would flow from time use surveys. Why don't policymakers or politicians or bureaucrats like this idea? Well, first of all, it's terrifying. They would have to exercise judgment. They don't have a unidimensional set of figures to which they can look and say, is growth up or down? Thereby hangs our decision. Language is a tool available to all of us. None of you, when you leave this room, should ever again say, my mother doesn't work, my wife doesn't work. That particularly relates to people who are in media or teaching positions. Push for parity. Join political parties and go to their annual conferences, and year after year after year, drive them crazy. Half the candidates shall be women. Half the candidates shall be women. Join this party till you get it through, then move on to the next one. I mean... Just as there is no one-way feminism, there is no one political tactic available here, there is no one political strategy. It is broad and as wide as our imaginations can take it once we have heard and seen and recognised that the emperor has no clothes. You must choose, judge, assess the strategy and tactic in your environment, in those communities that I don't have access to, just as I do it in communities you won't have access to. I mean, the only principles are that we don't stop, that we are rigorous, that we recognise that it's hard work, and lastly and not least, that we have a lot of fun along the way. Thank you.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
You know, the whole criminal justice crackdown fits in that it can both physically control large elements of the poor and keep their communities under surveillance and police occupation, and also simultaneously ideologically control them by promoting a story of danger and threat and moral failure and individual responsibility that explains away high rates of poverty as cultural phenomena rooted in individual failures to get up early and work hard, etc., etc.
That's the voice of renowned author Dr. Christian Parenti. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Parenti about the prison industrial complex and its relationship and growth with the rise of neoliberalism. So stay tuned.
Someone who looks at the way surveillance has a role in this capitalist society is my next guest, Christian Parenti. Dr. Christian Parenti is the author of several books. His latest book is Tropical Chaos, and we talked to him today about his last two books, Lockdown America and The Soft Cage, which speaks about the prison system in North America. Thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome. Fire away. What are the questions?
Wonderful.
What do people not yet understand about policing and prisons in the United States? I've been having this conversation for nigh on 15 years now. And frequently there are these resort to economistic answers coming from the left. The right, of course, says, well, you know, we're trying to regain order in a society riven by crime, et cetera, et cetera. But then the left resorts to these economistic answers about, well, it's private prisons and the exploitation of prison labor. And that's not really the explanation.
You know, I actually am glad that you said that, because I don't hold either one of those positions. For me, being from Latin America, I seem to think, or at least I feel, that there is a connection between the repressive nature of prisons and the culture of neoliberalism. I think that the violence is a productive force as well.
You were in a minority of people who correctly apprehend how the thing works. That's exactly right. And it's not just the culture of neoliberalism, it's the actual economic policies of neoliberalism that produce poverty deliberately and also unintentionally. They produce it deliberately. There needs to be a high rate of unemployment to keep wages down, so there's an element of deliberate production of unemployment. You know, if any time the economy gets going, you know, too robustly, there's always concern about keeping the, you know, determining what the natural rate of unemployment is and taking efforts to make sure that there are always people, more people looking for jobs than there are people to fill jobs, lest wages start being bid up and cutting into the capitalist class's profits. And unemployment is also created unintentionally because, you know, when you remove all the Keynesian social democratic forms of regulation and control, the business cycle is, you know, back in full swing. And so you get increased volatility, you know, more frequent bubbles and more frequent crashes. And in those crashes, as in the crash of 2008, and which carries on, there's, the, you know, production of massive amounts of unemployment, just sort of indirectly, unintentionally, you know, but as a result of the business cycle. So then the question is, in a capitalist society, if for the sake of keeping wages low, there must be unemployment, how are the poor to be managed physically, and how are they as a category, as a political category, to be managed? I.e., how are they to be managed discursively? How are they to be described? How are they to be explained to themselves and others to make them politically vulnerable to unburden the state and the wealthy classes of any responsibility for providing for them? And so that's where the, you know, the whole criminal justice crackdown fits in that it can both physically control large elements of the poor and keep their communities under surveillance and police occupation, and also simultaneously ideologically control them by promoting a story of danger and threat and moral failure and individual responsibility that explains away high rates of poverty as cultural phenomena rooted in individual failures to get up early and work hard, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, one of the important things I think that we need to make is that this culture of internalizes also in the population a sense of self-blaming. I'd rather see that the prison system produces the criminal. You know what I mean? Like they're both self-constitutive, right? As long as we create this culture of criminality, or instead of looking at the root causes, which you just addressed, you know, the wealth inequality, the inequality, the wealth distribution, you know, inequality, instead of addressing those issues, we instead create this narrative that the victims themselves become self-censoring. You know, I mean, we ourselves start to think, well, he must have done something. So I wonder if you could talk about that relationship, because I think that's where we're stuck, sure. Right?
And again, it works both physically and discursively. So you could say prison produces criminals in that it produces actual criminality. You know, if you go to prison, particularly when you're young, instead of going to school, instead of, you know, when you're being socialized, instead of learning a skill and learning appropriate social skills to operate in society and in the labor market, instead you learn how to operate in the criminal underworld, yes, prison definitely produces real criminality. People who come out, they're marked. It's harder for them to get, you know, they're legally marked, they have a conviction, it's harder for them to get a job, they have less skills, et cetera, et cetera. You know, to put it in mainstream parlance, you know, they have the equivalent of like a Rolodex of what? Of criminals, you know? So they know how to, you know, fence goods, sell drugs, whatever, whatever. So it produces actual criminality, but then it also produces the legal category of criminality, whether or not one is an actual doing moral harm or physical harm to others, you know. You can wind up back in prison. Basically, it produces recidivism because the laws around probation and parole are, you know, incredibly intricate and intense. And so it's very hard for people to be out on parole for very long and not violate their parole. And so, you know, in some states in the United States, you know, up to half of all the people entering prison are going in for parole violations. You know, it's usually not more than half. It's like, you know, in the high, like 40-something percent in major prison-holding states like Texas and California are going in for just routine violations, which is they, you know, they smoke some weed and they get drug tested, and conditions of their parole are that they're not supposed to smoke marijuana, and so, boom, back in for a year or whatever. You miss a date with your parole officer, back in. So it produces prisoners by producing these infractions and producing, you know, sort of officially generated recidivism in which people really haven't committed important crimes. I mean, clearly, no matter how you feel about marijuana, and I know you guys generally up there in the Canadian Pacific Northwest have a kind of civilized view of marijuana, but you know, I mean, even if one has some sort of backward view about marijuana and that it should be illegal, I mean, one would have to admit that missing a date with a parole officer is itself not actually a crime. I mean, there's not that much harm done to society, but, you know, that can land you back in state prison for a year in California or Texas or New York or Illinois. The prison produces actual social harm, actual criminal behavior. And it also produces the category and the legal mechanisms of recidivism, of just turning, you know, people who are no harm to others back into prisoners.
I want to talk about an interesting relationship that I think, well, a person can be incarcerated for stealing a loaf of bread, which, you know, if someone was hungry, I would personally not consider that a crime in a world where so many are denied the basic essentials. But a company can destroy an entire ecosystem and the entire livelihood of thousands of people and not be held criminal. Can you talk to this, to me, paradox?
In some ways, it's not really a paradox, right? I mean, it's a class society. Capitalism is a class society, and the government is both a mechanism of social control and an arena of social struggle. So there is some democratic accountability. You know, the legislative branch of governments in the United States are definitely, to some extent, democratically accountable. Popular forces can have influence on shaping policy, and the history of progressive reform in the United States is that history of popular progressive forces through direct action and protest and strikes and elections and operating in office, changing the laws, creating decent policy. But, you know, at another level, fundamentally, the state in a capitalist society is about reproducing the capitalist economic system, which has the capitalist class and the institutions that they operate through corporations at the heart of its agenda. And so, you know, this sort of legal criminality is part and parcel of the system. And, I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise. That doesn't mean we should accept it, of course, but, yeah, this is what happens when corporations are allowed to write the laws. And so, you know, I'm sure most of your listeners understand how that works. It's just like the privileges of vast economic power deliver these sorts of benefits. Be one a rich individual able to, you know, hire decent lawyers and delay, and beat some charges, or whether it's an institution that's such as BP, you know, getting away with hiding the evidence of the damage they've created in the Gulf due to their oil spill and negotiating what will probably turn out to be a penalty that's really, you know, a fraction of the overall cost to the government and the communities that depend on the ecosystem of the Gulf. And, of course, you can never actually, at a certain level, put a true economic value on an ecosystem. But, you know, to the extent that large parts of the regional economy depend on that ecosystem, you know, the damage is going to be far greater than what BP is, you know, eventually going to pay out through all of this. So, you know, this is what it appears to be. I mean, and I don't really, in my book, I don't really talk about white-collar crime. And I also don't talk about political violence, because those, to me, don't really require that much explanation. They are what they appear to be: large corporations using money to bend the law in their favor so they don't have to go to jail, pay fines, et cetera, et cetera. So, too, with political violence. Remember once when some talk, you know, based on Lockdown America, a former political prisoner asked, why don't you deal with political prisoners more? I said, well, because it is what it appears to be. I mean, why were the radical left, you know, armed elements of the 60s put in jail, hunted down by the FBI and put in jail? Because they challenged the state with violence. I mean, what is there to explain? You can then decide whether you think that's effective. You can decide whether you like their politics or don't like them, but like what is mysterious about that? It is what it appears to be. A group of people challenged the state, and the state, with its overwhelming power, fought them and won and crushed them and used the prison system and the criminal justice system to do that. But prison, general prison population, it's not so clear. Why are there 2.3 million people in prison and, you know, upwards of 6 million people under the direct supervision of the criminal justice system, either out on parole or probation, having to, you know, take drug tests and check in daily or check in weekly or wear electronic monitoring bracelets, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, why all of this? And why did this buildup begin in the 1970s and go through to now? Why were prison rates generally, rates of incarceration generally stable from the end of the Civil War through the 60s, and then suddenly there's this huge explosion. And so that is not as self-evidently apparent. You know, it's driving causes. So that's what I tried to explain. And it's, as you said in the beginning, you know, it's linked to the shift away from Keynesianism, away from a sort of burgeoning social democracy in the United States, rooted in the New Deal and Johnson's war on poverty, and a shift away from that towards neoliberal economic theory, you know, out with Keynes, in with Hayek and Friedman, and the idea that the state should remove itself from the economy. Of course, this idea is then violated in times of crisis and banks are bailed out, et cetera, but, you know, the theory is that the state must remove itself from economic activity, and first to go is, like, you know, social spending on all of the programs that support the working classes, assistance for healthcare, education, job training, et cetera, et cetera. And why was there that shift beginning in the late 70s and really taking off beginning in 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan? It has to do with the fact that the world capitalist system in the 1970s faced a profit crisis. And from the end of World War II until the 1970s, the golden era of world capitalism, you saw across the West rising wages, a rising standard of living for the working class, at the same time that there were rising taxes, high rates of growth, and also really robust corporate profits. And so corporations and the capitalist class were okay, more or less, with the Keynesian compromise because they could afford it. They could still make really quite record rates of profit. Those profits, the sort of average across the economy after-tax profit rates, peak in the mid-late 60s and then decline precipitously into the early 70s, and that's when there's a rethink starting in 73 that really is a shift away from Keynesianism towards neoliberalism. So what was the cause of that profit crisis? It was basically that the world capitalist economy had finally recovered economically from World War II, that the devastation of World War II was so profound that it basically took a generation to rebuild the other two poles of world capitalism, Europe and Asia, centered around Japan. And once that recovery was sort of mature and those core capitalist economies were built out, you had a classic crisis of overproduction, a crisis of overaccumulation. There was too much capital, too much money to lend, too many factories to produce blue jeans, washing machines, whatever else, electronics, and not enough demand for it, unless there was going to be some sort of radical kind of like deepening of the Keynesian compromise and an acceptance of low profit rates. The choice facing the capitalist class to restore their profit rates was to attack the working class so that the portion of the general social surplus produced by the economy as a whole that went directly and indirectly through, as wages and as benefits and social spending to the working classes, that had to be reduced so they got less so the capitalist class could get more, thus to restore profits. And that's exactly what the program of neoliberalism is and was. Cut tax rates on the highest income earners, cut corporate tax rates, allow for an expansion of loopholes, et cetera, facilitate the upward redistribution of wealth, and attack directly and indirectly all the facets of power of the working classes, attack labor. So, you know, that's what Reagan did. First thing he did was he comes in, he fires the air traffic controllers union. 11,000 people went on strike, and he fired them, and he was able to do this because actually a lot of them worked at government facilities, and, you know, then stacked the National Labor Relations Board with people who were totally hostile to labor, and those are the direct assaults on working class power. And then indirectly, you know, there began this whole discourse of the culture of poverty, that, you know, the kind of racist myth-making and baiting about welfare queens, et cetera, et cetera. And so the whole population, not the whole population, but large parts of popular opinion really turned against the poor, turned against this new kind of imagined image of the poor as lazy parasites extracting unearned income from the hardworking masses. And so you get this sort of perfect stand-in. I mean, it's actually the actual rentier class, you know, collecting dividends fits the, you know, they are the parasites essentially, and instead, you know, and the working classes do experience this extraction of from their labors, but then they are taught to falsely imagine that this is going to welfare queens and lazy people in the ghetto, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was like then a kind of actual popular consent built around the project of militarization, repression, incarceration of the inner cities, the highways, and increasingly all of America. I mean, this country is so over-policed, it's ridiculous. So there we are. We're still in the neoliberal moment, and there were moments where this was right before 9/11. There was definitely a rethink was underway, and it was creeping into sort of elite opinion making institutions like the New York Times and NBC. You know, were reporting on the criminal justice system in very, you know, not politicized Marxist terms as I just laid out for you, but in, you know, very, very critically, you know, about the human rights violations, et cetera, et cetera. And you actually saw incarceration rates in the U.S. begin to plateau and dip right before 9/11. And then, in the name of the war on terror, we get a whole new round of fear and paranoia and massive, massive federal largesse to any and all state and local police institutions to buy new equipment for surveillance, incarceration, and policing. And so, you know, the situation in a lot of America is that the schools are totally underfunded and the cops have more gear than they know what to do with.
I want to talk, though, about the sustaining forces behind it, because while we understand, and thank you for making those points very clear, the relationship between this war on terror and the insecurity that it creates in the population, the way that people self-surveillance themselves and perhaps do not resist when they would otherwise, right? Because you create this culture of fear and everybody's running scared. And when we're all scared, well, business goes on as usual. Facing that fact, people in Latin America, we're seeing it more and more in Europe, we've seen it in other parts of the world, in Africa, are rising up and standing up. And I wonder if you could comment on this, because it seems to me that within the capitalist system, we're always going to be back to this, you know, 3 steps forward, 10 steps back, right? We get Keynesianism, then we get neoliberalism. You know, the next stage, right now, we have a world where these practices of the war on terror, the war on drugs are being systematized. So there's this interchanging of information, interlinking. They're united. What's it going to take for us to unite our efforts and resist this?
That's the key question, and I really don't have an answer. I don't have an answer to, like, well, what social movements need to do is X, Y, Z. I do not know. But I can say that I'm hopeful. I mean, I guess there's one thing I could add, but first of all, let me just say I'm very hopeful about this moment of protest, and I don't know what the correct thing for social movements to do is. Those strategies and tactics have to be worked out by the people in specific places, engaged in real specific struggles. But one thing I would say, as an intellectual, I mean, my job is, I mean, I've been an activist, but I don't deign to sort of claim that mantle. I'm not really an activist anymore. I mean, I'm a scholar. I teach at a graduate institute and write books, and I'm a reporter. And it's like, so one thing I would say is I think we really have to take ideas and history seriously. I'm increasingly disturbed by how little history is in curriculum. I'm also increasingly disturbed by the role of technology. There's a whole kind of techno-bureaucratic enclosure of education, and people are increasingly concerned with the form of things and not their content. And I think that one major problem that the U.S. left faces is a kind of a lack of intellectually robust engagement with political economy and history, and that we too often resort to sort of moral explanations, individualistic categories, sort of methodological individualism to explain problems. We seek direct economistic explanations for things, and then that mentality lends itself to conspiracy theories that can sometimes be really wild and out there and really not helpful. And that the whole practice of analyzing and criticizing capitalist society and political economy requires, you know, a kind of thinking that we generally don't do. And part of it is that there's a very sort of utilitarian mentality, in, at least down here, this side of the border.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Christian Parenti. He's the author of four books, Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis, The Soft Cage, Surveillance in America from Slavery to War on Terror, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupy Iraq, and his latest, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Thank you again for being with us.